Here.
Member Fay?
Here.
Member Kobus?
Here.
Member May?
Here.
Member McCluskey? Member Rotroff? I think Rachel might be on mute. Member Rotroff? And President Kowalczyk?
Here.
I'm here.
Okay.
Okay.
Sorry, I think my headphones are messed up.
Okay, and we got Jerry?
Like he's still connecting.
Looks like he's trying to connect with audio.
Okay.
Hello, everybody.
Oh, hello,
hey,
Jerry.
Hi, Jerry.
Okay, we have the meeting.
I lost everybody's video.
We're all here.
We still have you, Virginia.
Okay, yeah, I can hear you. I just can't see anybody.
Okay. We see you, though.
Okay. I thought if I touched the screen or something, maybe I would see you again.
All right. I'm not an aficionado on Zoom. I couldn't tell you. All right. I'm just going to say just a brief statement, and then we're going to get started. You know, we're all concerned about what this next year will look like for our students and staff. Our administration has been getting feedback from parents and staff throughout this whole process and is tirelessly putting together a plan to bring our students and staff back to school the safest way possible. The entire board has children who attend D57 and or District 214, so we understand the questions and concerns that every parent has. Please understand that this is something very new for all of us, and we will get through this together. Okay, with that being said, do we have any communications? I'm sorry, we have Lynn Hines here to do any discussions we have regarding any policies regarding this COVID experience, anything we need to ask, questions that we might have regarding any policies that we need or have in place that helps us through this process. I'll start out because I had the first one when I had asked about the mask requirement, because it is part of the Department of Health's requirements that if when kids go back to school, that they would have to wear masks. And there's been, you know, things on Facebook saying some people are not willing to let their children wear masks or put masks on them. I just want to know the policy, if we have to use what we already have or put something new in place that specifies, you know, we will abide by these guidelines that have been given to us from the state, and that children have to wear masks. And if these requirements are not met, then what do we have to do in order to make sure everybody is safe?
Okay. Firstly, it's my firm's opinion that we don't need any specialized policies to do this, that you already have policies in your policy manuals that say that the superintendent's in charge of the school buildings and in charge of the school, and the superintendent is responsible for keeping everyone safe. That being said, some districts have decided they wanted to adopt policies so that they would have something to point to if they had a parent that said, you can't make me wear a mask, you can't make my little darling wear a mask, you don't have any policy. I don't think you need it, but if it will help, there's no reason not to do it. And in fact, I've even drafted an insert for your appearance policy and an insert for your student handbook that makes it clear you're gonna wear a mask. Now, we know that the children are not gonna wear a mask 100% of the time. We're trying to do the best we can.
Okay.
I don't think we're going to pick up any additional liability if we have a policy. I don't think we're going to pick up any additional liability if we don't have a policy. But it is something you can point to, and you can say to those unbelieving parents that, yes, we are going to wear masks.
Okay. Now, what if we still have parents who, even with policy, refuse to? Would they be an automatic remote learner if they're not willing to abide by these rules?
I believe you can make them an automatic remote learner. It would be the same as if the child decided that the child was going to come to school without pants every day. You say, no, no, we're not going to accept that. You're going to wear pants or you're going to stay home.
Okay.
And you would not have to devise a specialized learning opportunity for that child absent an IEP or a 504 plan. It's, this is what we've got available. This is where you're going to go.
Okay. Thank you. That's very helpful. And we have the attachment already with the policy. Correct, Elaine? The addendum to it?
Yes, I sent out the draft policy so that if the board was in agreement that this is the direction they wanted to go, we would satisfy the first read of the policy with our discussion tonight, and it would come before the board on August 20th for second read and adoption.
Okay. Does anybody else have any questions or concerns regarding any policies or anything for Lynn?
I do. Just to clarify with the masks, and I think the policy that Elaine sent out was pretty clear. We are talking about, I think they're referred to as like snug face coverings. So just to refer, or like for, to clarify for parents, we are talking about like the masks that either like tie behind your ears or behind your head, not the face shields that are plastic and come like 6 inches in front of your face, correct? That's our expectation for everyone.
Your statement is correct. The ISBE guidance on shields points out that there may be times when someone has to wear a shield because they can't wear the snug face mask, but recognize that when you're doing that, it's not as good. Mm-hmm. We may have teachers that are ELL teachers or special ed teachers where it's important to be able to see their mouth. We also may have children that couldn't remove a mask by themselves or something like that, and we would use a face shield. And it is merely a fallback. It's not meant to be a replacement.
Okay.
I was going to say, Eileen, as a follow-up to that, I know the draft policy provides a caveat for people, individual students who have some kind of legitimate medical condition that prohibits them from wearing a mask for the duration of the day. What sort of documentation would be required corroborate that, and what are the guidelines for other students or staff who might be in a room with people who has that condition? I mean, part of the concern is their safety. Part of it is also the privacy of that individual who might not want to be forced to disclose their medical condition.
I think that you have a right to have a note from a doctor that follows what we just talked about. Here are the reasons why you can't wear it. And here's the reason why you can't wear it for the duration and have a doctor certify that and bring that back in. We can use our own verbiage and say, you got to go to the doctor and get the doctor to say this applies. Now, as for others that will be around that child, I think you have to minimize it to the extent that you can, but you're not going to be able to do it 100% of the time. And the fact is, what we're trying to do is the best we can do.
Right. Does anybody else have any questions?
I have one also.
Okay. Vicki, go ahead first since I can actually see her.
Okay. Lynn, I just want to clarify. So your recommendation that we don't need to add in this language is because of that. It's because we just don't need it. You feel like our current policy is good enough versus that having this language could somehow create more of a liability for the district. It's just that we don't need it, not that this language could somehow be detrimental in some way.
Your statement is correct. I think you don't need it. I think it's belt and suspenders. If you adopt it, I don't think it detracts from your ability to do this. I don't think it adds any liability to you. I think all it does is gives you another place to point and say, see, we said explicitly you can't do it.
Okay, thank you.
Jerry?
I have a question about we've distinguished between parents who decide, you know, to send their kids with the mask to school and those who wouldn't, but if kids are at school and then they start taking off their mask and, you know, is that just a normal disciplinary process like anything else with the mask in terms of I'm not going to put it, I refuse to put it back on during the middle of the school day kind of thing, or?
Yes, we would handle it the same way. We'd escalate it the same way. We would try to use only as much discipline as necessary to correct the problem. And we would treat it just like we would if the kid kept pulling the shoes off and throwing them at the people at the front of the room.
Okay.
Okay, Brian.
Hi, Lynn.
Hey, Brian.
The plan that we're considering sets forth that for in-classroom learning, live learning, or maybe some occasions where the desks are not 6 feet apart. Do you have any concerns about that from a legal standpoint?
I think as long as we're doing the best we can do, we've done the best we can do. Even the ISBE guidance recognizes that there's some times when we can't get them 6 feet apart, but we're doing the best we can. 6 feet is better. Now, there is one county health department today came out with 3 feet because that's what the World Health Organization says. But Lake County says 6 feet. And best we can do is the best we can do. You know, we obviously can't put 51 people in the room if we can only get 6 or 8 or 12, and then that's all we can do.
Right. Okay. Thanks, Lynn.
Okay.
Eileen, I have one question. Sorry.
Okay. Go ahead, Rachel. I mean, Jen, sorry.
It's okay. So just a general question. I think I know the answer, but outside of us reviewing this amended policy, adding some language that has been shared, we feel like we're meeting all the ISBE standard requirements, correct? Like they haven't come out with, as of current state, whatever is needed to be adopted from a policy perspective, we feel comfortable. Is that a fair statement?
I believe so.
Okay. And then my second question is probably more for maybe Elaine, but so with this requirement, will there be, like I know a lot of, you know, companies who require masks will also have masks available, like disposable masks if needed. Is there any plan on supporting that, or is it more like just kind of up to the child and parent to be able to secure that?
The expectation is that the child comes with a mask, but we are prepared to provide masks if they don't have them for both students and for staff.
Perfect. Thank you.
Okay. Is that it for the questions, guys?
I have one more.
Okay, go Kim.
With regard to policies when it comes to staff, things like sick time and paid leave, would you say as well that our policies are up to date to allow for this new contingency?
Or yes, would we need I believe they are. I believe your policies are complete enough to handle this. There's some new statutes under the Family First that gives additional sick leave and gives additional FMLA leave, and we would implement that anyway. And further, if someone is trying to stay home, for example, because they're in the high-risk category, not that they're ill, but they're in the high-risk category, the guidance recently from the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission says that we should try to have the interactive conference with this employee to accommodate this employee and try to find a way to accommodate this employee. But the bottom line is that employee is not protected by the Americans with Disabilities Act because that employee is not disabled. They can come to work. They just choose not to, and it's not our fault that they're in the high-risk category. Mm. But I think everyone is going to try their best to accommodate, try their best to alleviate any concerns. And it's only going to be the rare exception when some employee refuses to cooperate in any fashion.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Anybody else? Okay.
Any investment advice, DUIs, securities transactions, anything?
No.
Those things would all be easier to address than what we've asked you to talk about, so we appreciate it.
There is one good thing about the pandemic. Think of the money that you saved on me driving to and from the board meeting.
Very true. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Good night.
Thanks,
good night.
Bye.
Okay, guys. Now we can go through our communications. Does anybody have anything? Brian, NSSEO report?
No, we didn't have a meeting this month.
Okay. Anybody else have any updates? Nothing? No? Okay. And we're going to get started here coming up with our community comments. And that's what I get to do now. And, you know, the community has given us quite a bit here to discuss. And they have quite a few comments here. So I'm going to read through them, and we won't be answering these questions before the presentation, because we believe many of these questions will be answered during the presentation, and the board will be asking questions and discussing some of these community comments because we've seen them, and we'll be discussing them after the presentation. I'm going to read them all. Some of them might be a little bit of a repeat, but since you took the time to email and write us, we should read all these the comments that I've received. Okay, we're gonna start out. Hello, Dr. Allmiller. Thank you for the opportunity to submit this comment to the board. While I believe the district will do everything it can to guarantee that kids are as safe as possible, I have followed the discussions on the local Facebook pages about how many people in our community think COVID is a hoax, not a real pandemic, and won't make their kids wear masks. They say not many kids will get sick. Setting aside, for the sake of this email, the health and safety of staff who will get sick. As a parent of a child with a medical condition that puts her at a greater risk for complications if she were to contract COVID, I am appalled that any number of children getting sick is acceptable. Schools should be a place that promote mental and physical health and well-being for all, not just the ones who are currently healthy. The same people say my child should just stay home. But as a two-educator household, we too will have to be returning to work, and she will need to take the bus and return to school in person regardless of a remote learning option being made available. I would like to know how the board and schools can keep high-risk kids safe given the already limited resources available, and also given the many in the community who are not taking this seriously, including something as simple as wearing a mask. Thank you for your time. Kim McClusack.
Eileen?
Yes.
Could you actually say the person's name before reading it? Because then it's helpful. Yeah, thank you.
This is from Paula Smeltkopf. We know students are likely to be asymptomatic carriers. We know countries who have successfully opened their schools and economies have used testing to identify and segregate the sick so that schools can stay open. Given these two factors, how frequently will we use school-wide testing to keep our community safe? Given that spending long periods of time indoors, more than 15 minutes, with others is a prime factor in the spread of COVID-19. How have the HVAC systems in our schools been modified to ensure proper circulation of clean air and safer filtering sanitizing of the air students breathe? We are all in this together. Given the grave importance to the community, how have we partnered with organizations outside of District 57 to help with the additional costs and personnel required to open safely? Daily temperature screening, rapid testing, contact tracing, materials for sanitizing and appropriate masking, HVAC modifications, community PSAs, etc. Okay, the next person is from Kelly Morales. Good evening. First of all, I want to thank everyone within the district making these tough decisions during this unprecedented time. Thank you for all your hard work and dedication to our district and our children. I am writing this message from a few different viewpoints. I am a District 57 parent, but I am also a current teacher, a past administrator, and have been part of scheduling decisions for many years, including this one. My letter is being written utilizing these different perspectives. There are two main points I am hoping to convey. The first and foremost is that I am hopeful District 57 offers a fully remote option to parents. I believe this is necessary because of the current trends in the virus that we do not fully understand. While countries work to get a handle on this pandemic, we are barely in a better position than we were in the spring. We still do not fully understand asymptomatic transmission, airborne spreading, long-term effects, the effects in children, or how to cure people with the existing virus. These are all still uncertainties. If District 57 does not have a fully remote option, I will be homeschooling my daughter. As a huge proponent of public education, these are certainly words I never thought I would say. In this scenario, though, the possible benefits of my daughter being in school do not outweigh the potential risks. The second point is that I believe District 57 needs to refocus from organizing in-person education to instead creating excellent remote learning instruction. Schools should not be asking parents about opting out of school, but instead asking parents about opting in. Remote learning should be the norm. While I completely understand the desire for in-person instruction, some parents work, have children who struggle, want social interaction, etc. The in-person instruction we are still used to is no longer existent in this current school year. Kids will not be socializing the way they have been without close interactions and shared materials. In addition, if we focus on the in-person instruction, this will leave teachers ill-prepared for the inevitability of needing to be remote. According to ISBE guidelines, not only does a person who shows symptoms need a self-quarantine, but also anyone who has been within 6 feet of this person for 15 minutes or more. This leads to a quick domino effect of students and teachers missing school. In addition, it is possible Illinois will return to phase three, which would make the current in-person plans obsolete. If schools begin focusing and encouraging remote instruction, teachers will be better able to create rich, engaging learning experiences for students. Teachers will be able to put their energy into teaching and building relationships with children instead of focusing on hand washing and mask wearing. While this pandemic has caused an extreme disruption to most of our lives, it is vital that decisions are made that keep the well-being of children and staff in the forefront. This would require District 57 to not only have a remote learning option, but also to focus on it. As mentioned, I am grateful to anyone involved in this tremendously difficult decision-making process. By nature, I am a problem solver. Should you need any help in any way, I am more than willing to lend a helping hand. We are in this together. All right. The next one we have is from Steve DeLuca. I know you are swamped with things regarding opening, but I would like these questions included in the meeting for this Thursday. Thank you so much for doing so much work. I know there is no scenario where everyone is happy with a solution. Thanks for listening to our input. Questions for school openings. If a teacher tests positive for COVID-19, are they required to quarantine for 2 to 3 weeks? Is their sick leave covered paid? If that teacher has 5 classes a day with 30 students each, do all 150 of those students need to stay home and quarantine for 14 days? Do all 150 of those students now have to get tested? Who pays for those tests? Are they happening at school? How are the parents being notified? Does everyone in each of those kids' families need to get tested? Who pays for that? What if someone who lives in the same house as a teacher tests positive? Does that teacher now need to take 14 days off of work to quarantine? Is that time off covered, paid? Where is the district going to find a substitute teacher who will work in the classroom full of exposed, possibly infected students for substitute pay? Substitutes teach in multiple schools. What if they are diagnosed with COVID-19? Do all the kids in each school now have to quarantine and get tested? Who is going to pay for that? What if a student in your kid's class tests positive? What if your kid tests positive? Does every other student and teacher they have been around quarantine, Do we all get notified who is infected and when? Or because of HIPAA regulations, are parents and teachers just going to get mysterious, may have been in contact emails all year long? What is this stress going to do to our teachers? How does it affect their health and well-being? How does it affect their ability to teach? How does it affect the quality of education they are able to provide? What is it going to do to our kids? What are the long-term effects of consistently being stressed out? How will it affect students and faculty when the first teacher in their school dies from this? The first parent of a student who brought it home, the first kid. Okay. Next, we have Allison Ramsey. To whom it may concern, first off, thank you for addressing our concerns as parents in what I'm sure is a very stressful time. I responded to the survey sent out last week that I was unsure as to whether or not I'm going to send my kindergartner to school in the fall. Over the past week, seeing the number of COVID cases increase and the lack of planning and funding on the national level, I have to say that my husband and I no longer feel comfortable sending her to school at the present time. I very much hope that the district is willing to work with parents and provide an online curriculum or a printable packet that we can do at home for the students that are not willing to risk in-person learning for the time being. I know that the teachers are probably very stressed at planning for the school year, but I hope we can find a way to work with the district to provide quality at-home learning. Next, we have Lindsay Mulligan. Good morning. Good evening, actually, sorry. Thank you so much for all that you and the staff have done to work through these circumstances. I do not envy you and want to assure you that my family will do the best we can to support the district and to positively engage with you as all progress through these trying times, as we all progress through these trying times. We have one question for the Board of Ed. Can you discuss the CARES Act and how District 57 can benefit from this relief? Thank you. All right, Zoe Giannakalopoulos. I apologize if I butchered that. Dear board members, Thank you for taking the time to read these comments. Many parents are still unsure about their decisions for the 2020-2021 school year. Many staff and teachers are concerned about their health and safety as well. Can the board please give more specific guidelines of how the district plans to do the following with in-person learning? 1, how often will classrooms be cleaned and who will be responsible? 2, if masks are worn, but there is a COVID exposure in the classroom, how will this be handled? Does mask wearing alleviate the need for others to self-isolate? 3, during lunch in the classroom, will all students eat at one time with all masks off? This one is a big concern for teachers especially. Can plastic sneeze guards be used during the lunch hour when masks are off? How will the drop-off and pickup process go? How will recess be handled? How long does a COVID-positive teacher or student need to stay home from school? Will teachers be able to come within 6 feet of their students? For example, when a student raises their hands to pass out papers, answer questions, etc., does wearing the mask allow for closer interaction than 6 feet between students and teacher? Can the board give more specific guidelines of how the district plans to do e-learning? Will teachers be assigned students from their home-based school, or will the e-learning teachers be a mix of all the teachers in the district? The recommendation for e-learning is currently 5 hours of face-to-face time. How will this be handled for the younger age groups, such as first graders? How will the teachers engage the students' attention for this long of a time? How will children be graded and held accountable for schoolwork? How will the district address the needs of students with IEPs, SPED, and children requiring literacy support? What will be done to address the social and mental health needs of the District 57 students? And what is the maximum amount of students for each e-learning virtual classroom? These are just some questions that keep coming up in parent forums. Although our family has decided on sending our kids to school if it is a possibility, many other parents and teachers need more information before making a decision. Can these questions be answered in this meeting? The more information we have at this time, the better. Thank you to all of the board and the amazing teachers and staff in District 57. Okay, next we have Leslie DeFrisco. Hello, thank you to everyone for all your hard work thus far. I don't envy anyone who has to make all these difficult decisions, especially when no one solution fits all. My questions are as follows. Do you currently have enough substitute teachers? Should teachers get sick or need a leave of absence due to illness or other personal issues? Who would cover for the teachers who are doing e-learning should they need a day off or a leave of absence as well? What happens if there's an outbreak amongst teacher support staff in the building? What happens to children who need one-on-one support in the classroom? What if their assistant gets sick? Many substitutes take teaching positions and not assistant positions because of the difference in pay. Have you considered changing that pay to get more substitutes to take assistant positions? What happens when there are not enough subs to cover classrooms and e-learning classrooms? Will substitute be trained to do e-learning? Thank you for taking the time to answer these questions so that as parents, we can make an informed decision about what is best for our children. Next one is from, I'm gonna get it wrong, Melgor Zada Glinska. Dear 57 board members, I am writing to express my family's opposition to requiring social distancing, masks, cloth face coverings, temperature checks, and numerous other measures as a response to COVID-19 in Illinois schools. These procedures are socially, emotionally, psychologically, and physically damaging to our children. Moreover, there is no solid science to support their implementation. First, current data shows that children are not an at-risk group for COVID-19. And the World Health Organization states that asymptomatic transmission is extremely rare. Additionally, recent data shows that fatality rates from COVID-19 are akin to a bad seasonal flu. Original predictions were grossly inaccurate. Throughout the crisis, many daycares have remained open and some countries never shut down schools, affirming that schools are not negatively impacting health outcomes. Second, requiring masks or cloth face coverings and social distancing impede schools and educating while causing psychological harm to students. Masks create a physical distraction to students and act as a barrier for teachers to effectively communicate. Masks and social distancing will psychologically impact students, particularly younger children and those with special needs. These measures reinforce an unhealthy concept of isolation as well as a fear of others, the world, and germs. Without the ability to physically interact or see the faces of adults and their peers, the special needs programs in our schools, including speech and occupational therapy, will be unable to function. Furthermore, the New England Journal of Medicine's May 21st, 2020 perspective states, we know that wearing a mask outside healthcare facilities offers little, if any, protection from infection. Third, re-outfitting schools so they can adhere to CDC guidelines will cause financial burdens to both schools and families at a time when both are already hurting from the economic shutdown. These measures will cause families who are unwilling to expose their children to these forms of social isolation to homeschool, potentially causing a job loss for a parent. Furthermore, the proposed hybrid model of schooling partially at home is not feasible for parents who need to return to work. This will lead to a financial situation from which schools may never recover while placing financial strains on families from a loss of income. Clearly, current data does not merit the dramatic response being proposed for schools. And the Illinois Department of Public Health and the Office of the Governor have not confirmed and have been unable to produce any findings from the CDC to support the theory that A, healthy people wearing cloth face coverings prevents the spread of illness, B, forced separation slows transmission, and C, asymptomatic transmission is occurring. In other words, there is no evidence that the CDC and the Illinois Department of Public Health guidelines are based upon science or medical evidence. Thus, the CDC and Illinois Department of Health guidelines considerations on which the governor and the Illinois State Board of Education are basing their guidance are founded on inconclusive assumptions with no reputable peer-reviewed studies to support them. It is my sincere hope that Illinois children return to school for face-to-face instruction with no hybrid models, no masks or cloth face coverings, and no social distancing. Illinois schools can increase cleaning, disinfecting, ventilating protocols, and encourage hand washing to accommodate the smaller number of parents who have concerns about returning. There is simply no justification for mandating an unhealthy new norm for all. I encourage you to please take a few minutes to watch an important message from Peggy Hall, an educator more than 30 years. She is based in California. She offers advice and facts that apply to all states. Thank you in advance for your consideration and for protecting our children by not mandating costly and drastic measures that hurt children and impede learning. All right, next up, this is actually from the Lions Park fifth grade team and fourth grade team, District 57 School Board and Administration. We recognize the time our remote learning task force, the MPEA representatives and administration have devoted to this difficult task and are thankful you are listening. We are hopeful you will act on our concerns by reconsidering the plan for a full return to school. We are concerned that our community is under the impression that the teachers on the task force developed the plan alongside administration when they did not. It's an important distinction to be made. When we think about returning to our classrooms at full capacity in less than 6 short weeks, we are frankly terrified and not okay with this plan. We understand that information and guidelines are changing daily, and at any time, we may have to go back to full remote learning. When we think about all the in-person learning details, it sends shivers of fear. We are the ones that could get exposed, sick, or risk our families becoming sick if this plan is not executed flawlessly across the entire school. Our natural tendencies to assuage our students' fears will be stifled by our own personal fears. Would you feel comfortable meeting, talking, supervising a lunch period while students do not have masks on and working for 7 hours in one of our classrooms with 25 people at this current time? This 5-day-a-week, full-day school environment will be unlike anything students have experienced in their lives. Is a teacher donned in PPE that is limited to interacting with 3 to 6 feet of a student the back to school you envision for the children District 57? Students will remain in the same seat for 6 hours a day. Any interaction between students and teachers will be from a distance. Students will be wearing a mask most of the day. Students will be eating lunch without a mask, therefore increasing their and our risk for exposure. How will we be able to effectively help monitor and guide a full class of students without the ability to physically get close enough to them to see their work? How will we be able to work and interact closely with our students individually or in a group other than using a technology platform? How will this feel any different than if we were teaching remotely? All the parts of in-person learning and social interaction that kids currently miss, crave, and love are considered high risk according to CDC guidelines. Imagine the day from an elementary student's perspective. It is a Tuesday and the weather is raining. You are sitting at your desk, spaced apart from your peers. You have been given limited opportunities for movement for 3 hours because you do not have specials that day and your room is too crowded for you to sit anywhere else. Now you wait your turn to wash your hands. You grab your lunchbox
and sit back in the same desk to eat among 25 other unmasked people while all facing forward. You may not be able to face forward or be separated because the classroom has tables rather than individual desks. Keep in mind, your parents have told you that you need to wear a mask while you are in public to be safe. You finish your lunch, wait to wash your hands again and put your mask back on. Since it is raining, there's no place for you to move around for recess. You are limited to staying in your same seat for another 30 minutes to play online games on your Chromebook, draw or read silently. After a short leg stretch, a desk disinfection and a bathroom break that may or may not be monitored for distancing, your afternoon learning schedule continues for the next 2.5 hours at that same desk. Keep in mind, data suggests the droplets from your maskless lunch will remain airborne that afternoon. We ask you, is this day of learning more engaging than a day of remote learning? If the district proceeds with in-person learning as IEA members, we need enforceable rules, policies clearly articulated to staff, students, and families. Policies that include both the policy and the plan for enforcement of the policy should infractions occur. The current district policy for behavior infractions is not specific to a pandemic situation. The mental well-being of the class needs to be considered here when they witness a teacher having to address a non-compliant student. Guidance on how the district will enforce the policy prior to the opening of school, and that guidance should also be clearly stated for staff, students, and families. Finally, according to the Illinois Educational Association, all educational institutions must meet the applicable Occupational Safety and Health Administration health and safety requirement to provide a place of employment free from recognized hazards that are causing or are likely to cause death or serious physical harm to the employees. We believe COVID-19 is a recognized hazard that has the potential for death or physical harm to staff and students as well as their families. We do not feel safe returning to a classroom that cannot follow 6-foot social distancing, CDC guidelines. District 57 has never been an employer where we felt our safety was at risk until now. We need to be safe and to do our jobs effectively. Thank you for listening to our concerns. Next up, we have Rachel and Paul Depsick. We have 3 children that attend 3 different schools in the district. We are firm believers in the importance of wearing a mask and maintaining social distance. The numbers, trends have moved in the wrong direction since initial surveys regarding parent concerns were initially completed. Can the guideline of 6 feet be maintained? What steps are D57 taking to ensure kids and teachers maintain 6 feet at all schools in the district? Is D57 still open to the idea of late start, virtual start to the school year, considering that space constraints make safe social distancing with full class sizes an impossibility? Is D57 still open to the idea of a staggered A, B schedule across all schools by last name, A through L, Tuesday through Thursday, K through Z, Monday through Friday, and Wednesday is a teacher plan virtual day to make social distancing possible? We recognize that decisions are being forced to make planning, and there is no way to plan for what is currently going on. We trust that the board will keep our kids safe, kids and staff safe. Thanks. Sorry about that last one. All right, next up, we have Deborah Kutzka. Hello, Dr. Allmiller. I would like to start by saying thank you to you and all involved for making very difficult decisions at this time. With an aim to keep our kids academically engaged and our entire community safe, I will not pretend to have the right answer because I truly do not believe there is a right or one-size-fits-all approach. I value the fact that students are having a tough time without the structure of school and that many families are simply unable to be home with them and support e-learning. For this reason, I understand a desire and even a need to have an in-person option. However, based on public health reports and data, COVID is simply not under control at this point, where we should be welcoming back all students and employees at the start of the semester. I believe it will be dangerous to open schools fully, not just for children, but for all employees in the district and their families. I do not believe that recommendations for a safe opening can be followed as strictly as would be required to ensure safety in each of our schools if everyone returns. To put the burden of protecting our kids into employee hands or the kids' own hands, depending on their age, is too much to ask. It is simply impossible for one teacher to monitor dozens of students' behavior when it comes to masks, disinfecting, social distancing, and self-reporting health concerns while teaching any sort of meaningful lessons at the same time. Not to mention the weight of thoughts about safety and health that remain on everyone's minds will certainly impact teaching and learning. I am married to a special ed teacher in a different district who will be required to return to school this fall. I saw firsthand the work, dedication, and sleepless nights that remote learning required this past spring. I know and trust that teachers will work their tails off to ensure that they are supporting students, whether remotely or in person. I am fortunate that my own employer, also in education, has allowed me to work remotely full-time up until now, and I hope I will have that privilege this fall. I believe that if those of us who can keep our kids home do, we will be doing our part to actively reduce the number of individuals in each of our schools and thus lessen the possible touch points through which this virus can spread. Keeping as many children as possible at home to do remote learning will result in more space for kids and adults who do need to go to school physically to appropriately social distance. It will allow staff the space to disinfect as necessary. It will reduce the risk that these individuals may face on a daily basis. Do I want to work from home all fall and support my kids in e-learning all day while balancing their social emotional needs? No, my anxiety is through the roof as it is, but I am also more comfortable knowing that our family can do our part to eliminate exposure and reduce spread as much as possible. And if I have that ability, I will. I urge the district to offer two options, one that provides on-site learning for families who need it, done in the safest way possible, following all recommendations, and another that allows 100% remote learning for families who are able. I hope that all district employees will be given that option, the option that works best for their health and their families, as well that they will receive the support they need on and off-site. Thank you for your time. All right. Next up is Joshua Kutula. I write to you before the board meeting to express my concern and hope that you and the board will opt to hold online classes instead of in-person classes until there is a safe vaccine. If this means after January 2021, then so be it. I'd rather the inconvenience of school at home versus the alternative of putting the students and staff in harm's way. I am a parent of two children at Fairview, and I'm deeply concerned with what may happen with schools reopening with in-class education during this pandemic. We are a higher risk family. Between asthma, having immunocompromised family members, and more susceptible blood types, we take COVID very seriously. Sending my children to in-person classes with this disease out there without a safe vaccine and or treatment is a risk my family is unwilling to take. I already see many kids and parents not adhering to recommended safe guidelines of social distancing and or wearing face coverings, and I do not believe these will be properly enforced at school. They sure aren't enforced now in sports programs or camps. This is not fair or safe for the kids and faculty. We are also not confident the schools will be properly sanitized often enough to be effective no matter what methods you put into place due to the nature of this virus. Food for thought. If students cannot be allowed to attend school if they are not vaccinated for mumps, measles, and the like, why would COVID be any different? Teachers and parents are all over the country are expressing concern and outrage with leadership suggesting and ordering schools to reopen without proper protections for students and staff. I support disobeying when the orders are wrong, and these, in my opinion, are very wrong. To date, your actions have brought some comfort to us. Last year, you and your staff immediately transitioned to online, and though it was challenging, it was the safe, right thing to do. Please continue to do this, to do what is right and safe, and consider online classes until a safe vaccine is available. Thank you. Next is Melissa Umali. Question, are there going to be guidelines for symptoms not COVID related that warrant keeping your child at home? There are symptoms that are not caused by COVID but are listed as probable COVID symptoms, which can cause confusion in keeping kids home and or warranting a COVID test. Congestion, runny nose not due to COVID. For example, if my child catches a cold from another student and starts sniffling at school but does not have a fever, will she or he be sent home or told not to come to school until the sniffles stop? Question two, if the congestion, runny nose does not stop for a week, will my child have to stay out of school for the entire week? If the congestion, runny nose persists but no fever, will my child have to take a COVID test in order to return to school? In regards to asthma, if my child has a cough due to asthma but not due to COVID, will he have to stay home until the cough subsides to a reasonable level of output? As an asthmatic, my child's symptoms could be mistaken for early signs of COVID, especially because asthma affects the respiratory system. And then finally, testing children. Will the school be able to provide a list of resources of testing sites that can be made available for children? Because of the increase in exposure to germs and viruses in addition to COVID, more children will start to display cold flu symptoms and the need to test for COVID will likely go up. if the swab in the nasal cavity testing method is employed, which I have heard is very uncomfortable for most people and must be done frequently in order for a child to return to school, a free testing site or sites and the site that uses other testing methods would help expedite the testing process. Thank you. Next up, Lisa Hazopoulos. Submit to today's board meeting. In addition to other questions, please answer in today's board meeting on record and with follow-up communications to district funding community. How and why district will or will not mandate masks for teachers and students with specific localized D57 data as to its reasoning. Masks based on localized data after 5 months is not recommended or suggested by CDC. Is it by IDPH? Please provide data supporting and with a forum for open discussion on social media and or website. To be more specific, please provide extensive analysis of raw data of COVID cases and death counts on a localized level to support the directives. Otherwise, this masking is not justified based on data which includes terminally ill and exponential growth of probable case counts. Absolutely ridiculous. It is absolutely necessary to obtain, provide, and properly analyze raw data without names, addresses, phone numbers from IDPH before making an educated decision instead of one that hurts Americans. It is unethical and unconstitutional to force healthy citizens to abide by measures that can result in physical and emotional harm and that impinge on their ability to move freely throughout society without discrimination. For those with deeply held religious beliefs, mass mandates violate their ability to abide by natural law and follow their convictions to walk in faith, not fear. As such, the decision to wear a mask is a highly personal one and should not be universally mandated. Measures that are meant to protect community as a whole are ineffective if they hurt individuals in that community. Share the power of education, lead by example. Otherwise, your powerful decisions are hurting your community yet again. Next up, Julie Babcock. Dr. Allmiller, in preparation for the board meeting tonight, as a parent of a Fairview student, I ask that the questions be raised, discussed, and clear direction provided afterwards. If a teacher tests positive for COVID-19, are they required to quarantine? If so, for how long? And is their sick leave covered? If a student tests positive for COVID-19, are they required to quarantine? If so, how long? Do all fellow students and staff that are exposed to the infected teacher or student in the school now have to get tested? Even if dedicated access points are assigned to classrooms throughout the school, how do you address the overall air quality and ventilation circulated throughout the school and that won't cause cross-contamination between rooms? Will there be tests conducted at the school or will families be responsible to confirm testing results on their own? And within what time frame? How are the parents being notified of infected individuals at the school? Does everyone in each of the teachers' or students' families now need to get tested? If offering only two choices, either 100% in-person or e-learning, will there be more teachers and aides added to the school staff? Since that positioning would appear to require two separate full-time positions from my perspective to ensure all students are getting the attention they need. For in-person learning, please specifically outline how social distancing measures will be handled in the classroom and hallways. Please note that our family, as many others, are torn between in-school and e-learning, as I know there's no perfect solution. Our children need the socialization of in-person learning, albeit at a reduced level. However, our concerns of safety in contracting COVID-19 feel inevitable if we send all the kids into the schools all at once. On the flip side, e-learning has its major challenges, including working families, and the question of how much the students retain in that circumstance. An organized hybrid would be my preference, but have yet to hear that's an option under consideration by the district. Thank you for all of your hard work and dedication to our kids. No one should have to face these difficult decisions, but we trust the board to put our safety and learning potential in the forefront for paving the way. Next up is Maria Amaro. I have two children enrolled at Fairview Elementary School. While I was not satisfied with the e-learning, I understand there was not enough time to put together a more effective plan. I have many apprehensions as far as having my children return to school. How will you ensure that our children are protected from feelings of anxiety over maintaining social distancing all day? Children are forgetful. How can you guarantee your assistants and volunteer staff are equipped to deal with this without creating an unpleasant environment? Are you planning to split up students? either by having them attend on alternate days or alternate mornings to afternoons, in order to ensure students are stationed at an acceptable 6 feet distance. What distance learning options are you providing? Some parents will not send their children to school because they do not believe it is safe. I am one of those parents. Some students are sickly or live with parents or grandparents with health conditions, which put them at risk of death from COVID-19. These students would also need distance learning. Have you planned ahead in order to accommodate? While most children will be safe eating in classrooms, what will you do for children who suffer from severe food allergies? Would children need to wear masks all day? Will you be taking students' temperatures before they enter the school? In view of the fact that COVID-19 cases are still increasing, would you consider pushing the reopening date to October? I will be watching the meeting at 7 p.m. tonight. I am eagerly awaiting answers to my concerns. Thank you so much for all your hard work. Okay, next is Anthony Amaro. First, I want to thank all the teachers and school staff for the striving effort they put forward towards the end of the school year when we were all caught off guard via this deadly pandemic. I first want to state that I understand and agree that in-person learning is the best fundamental way to teach our children for academic reasons as well as social and emotional growth. Unfortunately, this pandemic, and as the CDC and science shows, it is also the highest risk scenario. We love our children and do not want to endanger them or the hero teachers who will be put at risk by putting them at high risk scenarios without proper guidelines in place. Studies show that kids are less likely to keep a mask on properly, which is one of the best ways to prevent spread. The next suggested precaution is proper social distancing of 6 feet separation between children. Prior communications from the district allude to the fact that this will not be able to be enforced if schools are open at full capacity. If this is accurate, then we are creating a high-risk scenario, which as a parent, I feel uncomfortable for both my child and their instructor. Is the district willing to look at hybrid learning options, partial days in school and online learning, enabling small classes by staggering the students by days or morning and afternoon session? This is the only way to properly control class size. Other districts are offering this. Full capacity classes make following CDC guidelines impossible. What is the mindset of the district's precautionary steps for staff and students if this is the path chosen? Temperature testing is insufficient as there can be asymptomatic cases as science has proven. Thus, a child or teacher could be infected for days before showing a temperature and thus endangering others, especially if there is no proper distancing. Many states support homeschooling curriculums for parents which choose to do so. Unfortunately, Illinois is not one of them. Will the district consider doing so if parents choose to go this route? What modified layouts are being put in place for classrooms for both students and teachers, and what changes are made for cleaning and disinfecting our schools? If parents are not comfortable with full capacity classes, what other educational options are you offering? I would hope there are alternatives available as this involves human life and not all will agree with a forced approach. I thank you for your time and consideration, as well as the years of service you have provided in helping educate our children. Next is Kate Sassatelli. Dear District 57 School Board and Administration, I am a Lincoln Middle School staff member and I am a member of the district's remote learning task force. Like most other task force members, I do not yet know District 57's full plan for returning to school. In the absence of that knowledge, I would like to share some of my concerns in the hope that we will make decisions that prioritize the health and safety of our students, their families, and school staff. I have read the guidance from the Illinois State Board of Education, and I understand the state is pushing for a return to in-person learning. I know that D57 has been working hard to develop a plan that falls within that guidance. I also understand that as of this writing, over 3 million people in the United States have been infected with COVID-19, with over 130,000 of those being children ages 5 through 17. I understand that nearly 136,000 and counting Americans have died. Over 100 of those deaths were school-aged children, and 12 times as many were individuals in my age bracket. I understand that what the medical community knows about the virus continues to change and evolve, and that the case count across the country is exponentially higher now than it was when we closed schools in March. I am concerned that returning to school full-time will unnecessarily endanger our students, their families, and school staff. The CDC categorizes the district's communicated plan for return to school as highest risk. Those risks include full-sized in-person classes where students are not spread apart, spaced apart. Our regular middle school schedule simply does not allow us to socially distance to the best of our ability. With 30 students in a classroom, it is impossible to space individuals out by 6 feet, which is the recommended distance from both the Illinois Department of Public Health and the CDC. To my knowledge, there is not a plan for plexiglass platforms or partitions between desks, even though the CDC recommends physical barriers in areas where 6 feet of social distancing is not possible. Additionally, anyone who has been at Lincoln, in the Lincoln hallways during passing periods, knows that there are several halls where foot traffic is incredibly congested and is impossible to move without touching another person, let alone remain 6 feet away. Another concern is the fact that Lincoln students rotate classes throughout the school day, even though ISB and the CDC recommend having teachers rotate between classes instead. This means that a single desk will be shared by 3 to 7 students each day, and a classroom teacher would be exposed to the germs of 80 to 180 students per day. If the plan is for students to eat lunch in the classrooms, several different groups of students will then be exposed to the leftover airborne droplets from the maskless lunch group. If we are unable to maintain social distancing or limit the number of individuals who share classrooms, are we doing the best we can? The state guidance provides options for distance for districts to adopt blended learning days in the event that schools are unable to meet the requirements from the IDPH. A blended learning model would combine in-person teaching with remote learning so that we can stagger the number of students who are in the building at a time. With this type of creative scheduling, we could socially distance and maintain reasonable expectations for sanitizing shared spaces. It is my hope that the plan presented this evening encompasses the full breadth of District 57's creative resources, including options for blended learning and non-traditional scheduling, rather than choosing business as usual, masquerading in masks and hand sanitizer. Students, their families, and our school staff deserve the best possible plan to ensure everyone's health and safety to the greatest possible extent. Next is from Susan Howard and Mariella Ibrahimovic. My name is Susan Howard. I teach 6th to 8th grade French at Lincoln, and I have served in this role for the past 6 years. Although I am a member of the district's task force, I am unaware of the details of the plan being presented this evening. I'm writing in conjunction with Mariella, who serves as Lincoln's art teacher, to express our concerns and urge you to reconsider fully opening District 57 schools in the fall. Our deepest concern is the number of students that staff members will be exposed to daily without 6 feet of social distancing, which is the recommendation from both the CDC and the IDPH. For Lincoln teachers, we see anywhere from 80 to 180 students throughout the day without factoring in students in the hallways, during passing periods, or CSO and advisory groups. This means spending class periods in an enclosed space with up to 30 students without 6 feet separation. This scenario, which is likely to occur with a full return to school, is categorized as high risk by the CDC. In Arizona, 3 teachers contracted coronavirus while sharing a classroom, but only 2 of them survived. According to CNN, they followed the guidelines for a safe return to school, social distancing, wearing a mask, using hand sanitizer, and they were in the classroom for only 2 hours a day. What does that mean for our return to 7 hours per day, where we won't be able to distance at the recommended 6 feet, but only 1 to 3 feet? Are we willing to risk the health and safety of staff members and students, as well as the respective families? We love working at Lincoln and we miss our students immensely. We are eager to get back to school, but only in an environment that prioritizes safety. We do not feel safe returning at full capacity, and we urge you to consider creative solutions so that we are able to maintain 6 feet of distance during the school day. According to a Mathematica study, for the Pennsylvania Department of Education, if schools don't socially distance or implement a hybrid schedule, the average school would have 5 infections within 5 days of reopening. Given that Pennsylvania has 60,000 fewer cases than Illinois, it's logical that we could see a higher number of infections within the first 5 days of reopening. Is that a risk we want to take? Additionally, this study suggests that the best course of action is opening schools with part-time attendance and smaller student groups. They assert that this method is as effective as keeping school buildings closed entirely. Additionally, letters from my colleagues are attached. Thank you for listening to and acting on our concerns. All right. Next up is Julie Jesuit. My name is Julie Jesuit. I am a Spanish teacher at Lincoln Middle School. This coming school year will be my 21st year in District 57. I am writing to you because this is the first time during my tenure in District 57 that I have experienced fear for the health and safety of my students, my colleagues, and my own health. as a result of the format that may be used to deliver instruction to students this fall. I would like to acknowledge the enormous amount of time that district administration, members of the Remote Learning Task Force, and MPAA has devoted to planning for the return to school in the fall. While I do not definitively know the final plan that will be presented at today's Board of Ed meeting, I am concerned that we are most likely looking at a full return to school where all students may be present each day, making it impossible to socially distance students and staff. And the CDC's guidance published for reopening schools under the Guiding Principles to Keep in Mind section, the CDC states the risk of COVID-19 spread increases in school settings as follows. Lowest risk, students and teachers engage in virtual only classes, activities and events. More risk, small in-person classes, activities and events. Groups of students stay together and with the same teacher throughout across school days and groups do not mix. Students remain at least 6 feet apart and do not share objects. For example, hybrid virtual and in-person classes, structures or staggered rotate scheduling to accommodate smaller classes. Highest risk, full-size in-person classes, activities and events. Students are not spaced apart, share classroom materials or supplies, and mix between classes and activities. According to the CDC's guiding principle, schools in D57 would be reopening with the highest risk for spread if classes are in full attendance with less than 6 feet of social distancing in classrooms. In addition, classes at Lincoln will be mixing between classes. Lunchtime will be one of the most dangerous times of the day. Students and staff members will be both eating and talking in classrooms with no possibility of social distancing, with a full-size class in some, many instances, 30 students in the classroom. The 38 minutes that we are eating lunch will allow for the greatest possibility of transmission of the virus to students and staff members, and in turn, the possible transmission to the family members of students and staff as a result of exposure during this time. According to Harvard Medical School, aerosolized coronavirus can remain in the air for up to 3 hours. We have seen in news reports that congregate settings where masks have been removed or are not worn have repeatedly been seen as sources of increased virus transmission. During the 38 minutes that we are mask-free eating, all it could take is a single breath in before someone takes a bite of a sandwich and the transmission of the virus could take place. Unknowingly, that individual then goes home and exposes their family members to COVID-19. As an educator, I want students to receive the best education possible, whether it be in person or online. A full return to school presents many challenges to providing curriculum to the students at the same high standard that my colleagues and I are accustomed to providing. In the world language classroom, speaking is at the heart of the curriculum. Without speaking tasks, how do we prepare our students to communicate? Students will be required to complete speaking tasks, but only with the student next to him or her in the adjacent row, since they will all need to be in rows facing forward. Students will not be able to wander to the next partner for more practice. According to Stanford Medicine, if two people are wearing masks, the viral particles can travel about 5 feet away from each other. However, in our full-size classes, students will be less than 5 feet from each other as they speak. In my classes of 6th, 7th, and 8th grade Spanish, students circulating around the room will now be a health hazard. Students will no longer be able to gather into teams for Quizlet Live and work together to practice new vocabulary. The use of shared manipulatives and other supplies such as Jenga pieces for speaking activities will not be possible under the current health circumstances. The students will be limited to working at their seat, greatly reducing the opportunities for peer and group work, at least face-to-face. As an educator, I am not only concerned about the education my students receive, but also their social-emotional well-being. We want students to be in school so that they can receive the social interaction that is important for their development. However, how will students feel seeing teachers and peers who are anxious because they are concerned about their health, especially those who are at higher risk and the health of their families? I worry about the effect on the students' well-being if they see fellow students and staff members become infected with the virus as a result of lack of social distancing in the school environment or worse, die. I am asking that you take into consideration the CDC guidelines and adopt a plan that allows for 6 feet of social distancing as recommended by the CDC guidelines, which promotes a lower risk of spread of the virus. Thank you for listening to my concerns. Next is just a concerned teacher. I am a current teacher in your district, and I, as well as many of my colleagues, have extreme anxiety about returning to school in person in 4 to 5 weeks. You all are well aware of the science related to COVID-19 and how there are still so many unknown factors concerning the virus, including the long-term effects it will have on survivors. I ask that you take the science and data from the health experts into consideration as you make this decision. As a teacher, I want to be in the classroom with my students, but not at the cost of lives. Unfortunately, I have experienced the death of two teachers during the school year many years ago. The days following those deaths will forever be imprinted on my mind. Grieving the loss of beloved colleagues along with students is an experience I never want to go through again. Students were devastated and had a difficult time learning, as you can imagine. They didn't understand their deaths, and teachers quickly became grief counselors because that's what we do. We add titles to our job based on the needs of the students. Yes, the students need to be educated, but they can be done. That can be done in other, more safe ways. I'm afraid that if we turn fully in person, I will experience that grief again, which no child should have to go through. Please consider an alternative to full in-person learning, potentially a hybrid or full remote, but returning in person is not safe at this time. Thank you for thoughtfully considering the health and safety of all people involved and the reopening of our schools. This is also a Lincoln Middle School staff member. As a D57 staff member, I am writing to you today to express my sincere concerns for the district's plan to reopen schools at 100% capacity. As a whole, I believe we want what is best for students, staff, and families of D57. Even if we returned to 50% capacity, roughly 400 people in the building, would you feel safe? Returning to school in person at full capacity drastically impacts the safety and well-being of everyone involved. It is terrifying to fathom the thought of safely housing around 800 people daily for 8 hours per day, while adhering to the CDC and IDPH guidelines. If we as a district cannot guarantee that we will follow these guidelines with 100% fidelity, then we should not be putting staff, students, and families in this potentially lethal environment. Given these guidelines, it would be nearly impossible to abide by at Lincoln Middle School, as students are frequently shoulder to shoulder in hallway stairwells, and while they are learning in classrooms of 30 plus students. This does not even cover our co-taught classes where there are already two teachers present in a class of 30 plus students with additional support from instructional assistants. When thinking about supporting our special education population, they are immediately impacted the second they walk in our building. No longer can they receive those close individualized check-ins. Students with executive functioning deficits will struggle even more, since staff will not be able to assist them with tasks that they were previously safe to do so at a close proximity. Binder clean out, locker clean out, organizing materials, Chromebook difficulties, etc. If we cannot be safely within 6 feet of a student when working one-to-one, how are we supposed to efficiently and effectively support them? Also, what about students who have sensory needs? No longer will they safely utilize the sensory room or be provided with fidgets. Several students can occupy the sensory room within a 15-minute time frame. How will we guarantee that this is a safe space for staff and students during times of crisis? As a district, we have been working tirelessly to address social-emotional learning for our students. What about the teachers? How are teachers going to be able to comfort students when they are worried about their own safety and well-being? How does the stress of returning to school affect the mental health of our teachers? How will this affect the quality of education teachers provide? This issue goes far beyond only supporting the needs of our students. We need to equally support our staff who are on the front lines every day. When deciding which option to move forward with in the fall, please keep in mind that within the remote learning environment, we can guarantee that as a district, we chose the best option to keep our students, staff, and families safe. Until the state deems that we are in a position to safely reopen all communities and businesses, we should be utilizing the remote learning option. Nothing would be worse than the death of the district. Please remember, school is never closed, only the building is dead. Next up is a concerned teacher. I do not feel safe returning to school. District 57 has been my proud home for the past few years of my career. I've always admired how D57 always put the students first and how the staff bands together to do what's best for the students. Returning to packed classrooms that cannot abide by social distancing is not what is best for the students. As a task force member, I have sat through all the meetings. We are not the decision-making body. We are presented the district's decisions briefly before the parents and staff are informed. We do not contribute to the decision-making process. What I am still confused about, however, is how on June 16th, Dr. Gore presented the three plans for returning. Scenario one, full in-person learning, which would be phase five, fully restored. Scenario two, full remote learning, which is a flattening or recovery. And three is a blended hybrid, which would be phase four revitalization. How did we get to scenario one? We are not in phase five. If we cannot fill a restaurant to full capacity if we cannot sit next to each other outside without a face covering? Why are we going into classrooms with full capacity and not socially distancing? If the city of Chicago's mayor is scolding young people for crowding into bars and outdoor gatherings, for being responsible for the uptick in cases, how can we possibly have 31 students plus a teacher, and in some cases, one or two instructional assistants in a room, and that be okay? As it has been abundantly clear, this virus does not discriminate. This virus doesn't care who you are, your age, or what you like. Please do not put us in a COVID-19 breeding ground. I have endured every teacher's nightmare, saying goodbye to a student one day who went home sick but then never came back. The impact that had on learning for the rest of the year was profound. Please don't put any student or teacher in that position. Please don't risk the lives of students and staff because a governing body says you can. Please do what is best and can assure we all will be together again in our classrooms soon with all of D57 students. Any amount of illnesses and death is too many. I do not envy anyone making decisions about returning to school because there are such passionate opinions on both sides. But please, I urge you to do what as educators always do, use the data and science behind it. I understand we are following what surrounding districts are doing, but there's an opportunity to be a leader and do what's right to keep the number of cases down and everyone healthy. We're getting there, slowly but surely. Rebecca Pollard. My name is Rebecca Pollard and I am an eighth grade math teacher at Lincoln Middle School. I am also a member of the MPEA Teachers Union. I've been a teacher in this district for 6 years and I'm currently serving on the Remote Learning Task Force for District 57. As a member of the district's task force, I am unaware of the plan that will be shared today. I am writing to express my extensive concerns regarding the district's apparent plan to return to full-time instruction for all students in the fall, especially in a middle school setting. To begin, I fully acknowledge that this is an impossible situation. I completely understand that there is not a way to address the concerns of every teacher, administrator, community member, and student. There is, however, a way to prioritize the health and safety of the aforementioned individuals. At this moment, I do not believe the current iteration of our reopening plan effectively accounts for those two important priorities. As a member of multiple task force committees dedicated to reopening for the 2021 school year, it is my understanding the district is planning to reopen schools with limited attempts to reduce class sizes. This means a typical middle school teacher will come in contact with 80 to 180 students per day, and students will continue to move from class to class without hallway capacity restrictions. This clearly presents massive exposure scenarios. Under this plan, our schools will not be able to maintain the required 6 feet of physical distancing laid out by IDPH and outlined in CDC guidelines for school resumption this fall. In fact, the CDC would categorize our district's reopening plan as highest risk. Furthermore, just yesterday, Governor Pritzker reiterated the importance of schools adhering to state and federal guidance at the risk of districts being held liable if the worst should happen. IDPH requires students and staff maintain the 6 feet of distancing. A guideline also enumerated by ISBE and the CDC is within District 57 ability to create a hybrid learning model to meet that requirement. I urge the board to diligently consider this option for the upcoming school year. When school closures first occurred in March, I, like many others, believed that we would be out of school for 2 weeks or maybe a month at most. It was beyond the realm of possibility that I would be writing a letter to our Board of Education in the middle of July urging you to not send all students back to school full-time this fall. As a math teacher, I understand the impact of not holding in-person classes. I understand that my students cannot learn at the same rate or at the same level as when I am with them in the classroom, but I also understand that a classroom of 30 students spaced out to the best of our ability is not going to provide for a productive learning environment. If the worst should happen, and we are asked if we did everything to the best of our ability to mitigate a tragic situation, I do not feel we can answer that question with an honest yes. We can prioritize health and safety while creating a robust hybrid model for the school year. That is to the best of our ability. Thank you for consideration and time. Antonina Borowski. Good day, Dr. O'Miller. I hope this email finds you well and healthy. Before your next Board of Ed meeting, I would like to appeal to you and the board to consider offering a hybrid option for the next school year, where students can attend school several days a week, or they can be split into AM and PM shifts, similar to kindergarten. I am confident with rising rates across the country, we are not ready to go back to school in person. No matter how much I'd like to go back to reality, there is simply no way to distance students and teachers within our schools. I have two students, one at Lyons Park and one at Lincoln, and cannot imagine how Lincoln students can maintain social distancing. By offering students a hybrid version, schools can maintain social distancing. Children will be accountable for what they are doing remotely and would have an opportunity to ask their teachers in person if they are not understanding something. And online learning did not work for us really well. And unfortunately, I don't think 100% in-person learning will be sustainable this year. Naperville School District offered an e-learning and hybrid version for the 2020-21 school year. And I truly believe this is the most realistic scenario we can maintain under current circumstances. Thank you for your consideration. Next is Christina Jovich. I have two questions as back to school plans to be announced. If online learning is not offered, will homeschooling resources be provided to my family so I can ensure my child receives credit for the school year? When the virus inevitably surges again and school will presumably shut down, what is the plan at that time? And thank you. Next is Jill Chuck. In regards to the most recent survey that was sent out to parents, I'm curious as to why a hybrid or in-person learning and e-learning was not ever an option in terms of what parents might find best for their children. Sarah Ellis writes, my apologies for the last minute email. While I have many questions and concerns, here are a couple that may not have been addressed. Since the variety of COVID-19 symptoms are so vast and can be the same as the common cold, influenza, allergies, etc., it stands to reason that children should not attend school if they have any related symptoms. Cough, runny nose, et cetera. If a family chooses in-person instruction, will an option for remote learning be available when children need to stay home for minor symptoms? How will remote learning be handled among Lincoln Honor students? If a family chooses remote learning, but the rest of the class still meets in person, is there a concern about a disparity between the level of instruction? Will that student now fall behind their peers? The next is a common concern, but it's crucial. There seems to be a misunderstanding about the need for both masks and distancing. Wearing a mask does not negate the need for 6-foot distancing. While I understand the difficulty due to staffing issues and student population, why is there not an option for some sort of hybrid learning to reduce in-person class size? Thank you for your time and consideration. This is from Erica Johnson. As a resident of Mount Prospect, I am very concerned with D57's protocols for opening school buildings safely. I have several questions regarding the health and safety of our students and staff. With classes that can exceed 30 children, how do you plan to practice any amount of social distancing? For the middle school, how will you ensure the safety of students during the passing periods? For the middle school, will desks be cleaned between each student? Whose job is that? If teachers are expected to clean the room, then who is monitoring the students in the hallway? How does the district plan to keep up with the proper cleaning and sanitizing products when they are in such high demand? What is your plan when a student or staff member tests positive for COVID? Who will quarantine? What about a family member of a student or staff member? How will that be handled? If parents are given an option for remote learning, will it be at the same level of instruction as the in-person learning? Who will be teaching the remote learning classes? How many students will be eating lunch together? Students have to take masks off and cannot be socially distanced. This is very unsafe. At one point, will closing down the school and switching to e-learning completely would be taken into consideration when an outbreak of COVID-19 occurs? Have surveys been conducted regarding the comfort levels of educators, parents, and community members with full-time in-person learning? If so, what were the results of these surveys? If not, we need to be considering all impacted parties in this decision. Next up, we have Yulia. Yulia, I apologize for saying it wrong. Sorry. Thank you and all District 57 teachers and administrators for your hard work adapting to our new and hopefully temporary reality. As you continue to plan for the upcoming school year, I hope a large emphasis is made on creating a robust e-learning option. The reality is that the virus is running rampant throughout the country and the federal government has made no tangible progress with the containment, treatment, testing, or tracing. We are on our own. Although Illinois has done well containing the initial wave of the virus, because we are not an island, it is very likely, especially combined with fall, winter flu season, that we will soon find ourselves facing large increases in cases and rollbacks of reopenings. A robust e-learning option will be vitally important if we face that reality. As a working parent myself, I understand the desire or need of many parents to go back to normal so they can return to work. But as a parent who is concerned that we don't yet understand the long-term impacts of the virus on the children, I am very reluctant to send my children to school if the major mitigating efforts of virus spread are not implemented. Social distancing is one of the main ways to prevent the spread of the virus. Having been in my children's classrooms, I cannot see how an in-person, all kids at the same time, all day attendance will allow for social distancing. Face coverings are another mitigating technique, but we have to be realistic that young children will struggle to keep their face coverings on for long periods of time, and therefore the ability to social distance is vitally important. This is why I hope you will consider a hybrid option. Many Illinois school districts are offering this, and split the children into small groups that attend in person for part of the week and learn via a robust and modern e-learning option during the remainder of the week. Governor Pritzker put it well in his remarks today regarding school reopenings. Today, to be very clear here, any district that intends to disregard this guidance is gambling with the lives of our children, teachers, and families. Districts that don't live up to the public health guidelines and standards and don't make a genuine attempt to protect their communities from this virus could be held liable in the courts by community members who are ill affected. I understand that parents are worried sick about having to choose between seeing their kids miss even more in-person schooling at a critical ages and the very real threat of this virus. Good people with good intentions can disagree on how and when kids should go back to school. But let me be clear, I wouldn't let my own children return to school where masks are not mandatory and serious effort hasn't been made to keep parents distanced during the day. This should not be controversial. Thank you. Next is Dallas Tomlin. I realize that school boards and administrations are currently in a terrible position as they make decisions for the fall. No matter what decision is made, there are going to be unhappy parents and kids. While I do have many questions regarding the reopening of school, I am sure that you have received numerous emails covering many of the questions. I do, however, want to send you this article published yesterday regarding the positivity rate for children. It seems to negate the previous thoughts that children are not contracting disease. In fact, they are contracting disease at much higher rates than the general public. Florida has tested about 55,000 children and 31% of the children are positive. Overall positivity rate in Florida is 11%. Even more alarming is the fear that contracting the virus could cause long-term medical issues for children, even those that are asymptomatic. According to the article, they are seeing there is damage to the lungs in these asymptomatic children. We don't know how that is going to manifest a year from now or 2 years from now. Alonzo, the health department director of the Palm Beach County, told reporters, is that child going to have chronic pulmonary problems or not? I know virtual learning is not ideal, but the safety of our children, the teachers and staff must be paramount. Thank you. And last is from Liz Fisher. I want to start off by saying how much I appreciate how hard I know you are all working on planning for the upcoming year. I can only imagine how difficult this task must be, and I know that whatever options are presented and approved will be met with criticism. There are no good or easy solutions here. It is with that in mind that I share that my family has made a difficult choice to keep our children home for the coming school year. The easy is to be entering kindergarten, and she was to see her friends and teachers again. So to finally learn to read and to do math. Our oldest will be entering third grade, and while we had a bumpy transition year into second grade, she was very excited to go back and see her friends and has been talking nonstop about finally learning multiplication. Both of our children really struggled with remote learning, and while we know that everyone, children, parents, teachers, admin, were thrust into this new and ever-changing normal, and that everyone adapted as quickly and as best as they could, it was not a good fit for our second grader, a bright student with ADHD and sensory processing disorder. We were nervously excited when we entered phase four and were hoping in-person school would be a safe option for both our children. We know that to mitigate the risk of contracting the virus, both distance and mask wearing has been proven to be effective. We were concerned by your statement that the recommended 6 feet of distance would not be adhered to in our children's schools. Further, with so many members of our community refusing to follow the state mandate to wear masks when those people send their children to our schools, we do not trust the school to enforce the mandate. It is because of these reasons that we, like many families, have made the difficult decision to keep our children home. As such, I hope that the district will offer a robust remote learning option that is comparable to the in-person education that our children would receive if it were safe for them to attend. Okay, and that's that. There was a lot of comments and I'm going to actually just start with Lane, if you want to start with the 2020 back to school update.
Yeah. We have a presentation, a video that Mary and Adam and I put together for you tonight to explain the reopening plans. We will send it out to the community tomorrow via an email, a link that they can see it if they weren't able to tune in tonight with you. But before we get to that video, I want to make you aware of some chatter that is going around from a lot of networks. And that is that tomorrow it is being said that Governor Pritzker is going to announce that we're all going to remote learning in the fall. The sources are pretty reliable, and it might not be that he makes the announcement tomorrow, but it seems to be inevitable that he's going to make the announcement. So the plans that you're about to see could all be a very moot point. So I preface our presentation with that, and then we'll turn it over now and we'll show you the video. Mark, can you play the video?
Yep, let me just load that.
Hello, I'm Dr. Elaine Allmiller, Superintendent of Schools of District 57. My team and I are pleased to share with you our plans for reopening school in August. We've all been on an unexpected journey since last March with a lot of twists and turns along the way. And there are still many unknowns and uncertainties with regard to COVID-19 and its impact on schools. But one thing I can say for certain is that our number one priority in District 57 is to effectively educate our students and make sure they remain challenged, engaged, and supported, but in a way that is safe for them as well as for staff, even if the public health situation continues to evolve. So today we present the District 57 readiness plan to safely re-engage students and staff in the 2021 school year. I'm going to provide you with some initial information, and then Dr. Mary Gore, Assistant Superintendent for Teaching and Learning, and Adam Parisi, Assistant Superintendent for Finance and Operations, will give you a detailed overview of our current plan. At the end, we will share important next steps, including the fall attendance plan form that we will need for each student by Monday, July 27th. As you know, we are now in phase four of the Restore Illinois plan to reopen the state. This revitalization phase permits gatherings of 50 people or fewer and allows schools to reopen as long as they follow guidance from the Illinois Department of Public Health and Illinois State Board of Education. The official guidance was released to school districts and the public on June 23rd. Since then, my administrative team and I, with help from the Staff and Administrator Task Force, have been refining our plans for transitioning back to school on August 20th. What has gone into this process? Well, we've spent a great deal of time making sure we're up to speed on the latest advice from the public health experts, analyzing the state guidance while determining what it means for our four schools, and gathering feedback from our stakeholders, parents and guardians, as well as staff. We sent another survey to parents and guardians after the state released its guidance. We had an excellent response rate of 1,500. I thank the many families who took time to share their feedback because this has been a very important part of our planning process. Here you can see a summary of what we learned. Based on the information that was available at the time, 59% said they would definitely send their students back to school for in-person learning in the fall, while 39% expressed hesitancy. 41% of parents said they would like to have the option of enrolling their students in full-time remote learning. Dr. Mary Gore is now going to tell you about staff feedback and the role of the task force, and then get into specifics about the fall.
Thank you, Dr. Allmiller. My name is Mary Gore, Assistant Superintendent for Teaching and Learning here in District 57, and I'm grateful to be with you tonight to talk about our plans and the work that we've engaged in over the summer to prepare for fall 2020. I want to take a moment to thank Dr. Allmiller for her leadership and the Board of Education for being supportive in our work, as well as our entire administrative team and all the staff who have worked tirelessly to ensure that what we are sharing tonight is viable and driven by our ideals to support quality education for children in District 57. I also want to thank all of the District 57 parents who participated in our surveys, our focus group sessions, and contacted us individually to share suggestions and concerns and support for this work. This truly has been unprecedented in nature. However, I am reassured that District 57 is an incredible district with incredible people who are committed around a common purpose. And I'm confident that we will continue in that spirit and do whatever it takes to keep our students and staff learning and thriving in a safe environment.
Right.
I want to take a moment to talk about our staff leadership in our return to school planning. We've had wonderful participation across our staff in our district surveys. And in these surveys, our staff have indicated a desire for some options, both an in-person option and a remote learning option, which is consistent with what families have also expressed in surveys. We've had a committed task force who has worked many hours to provide different perspectives around this challenge. And there are representative staff members from each of our four schools and our administration building, all together with 63 teachers, ESP staff members, and administrators on this team. We've had three working groups hard at work this summer. The operational planning team has been led by my colleague, Adam Parisi, and Sarah Tyberski, and the teaching and learning teams for in-person instruction and also remote instruction have been led by myself and Sarah Tyberski. So we are very grateful for her leadership as she supports our work as the Director of Student Services. I want to also thank our MPEA and MPESPA union leadership teams. They have been extremely collaborative and supportive and willing to have ongoing conversations where we are ensuring that all planning is aligned with our commitments and our values to provide high quality learning and safe environments for students and staff. They continue to be invaluable, and we work very closely to ensure that all decisions are made with all of our stakeholders in mind. Now I'm going to talk about the overview of the choices that all District 57 parents will be asked to choose between. We are asking that parents make a decision by Monday, July 27th, in order for us to have appropriate planning and programs in place to accommodate the requests. We are eager to get this right, but we are going to need your support to have enough time to make arrangements and change our existing plans to accommodate two options. The first option will be full-time in-person learning. This will, of course, include increased health and safety modifications, increased cleaning and sanitation, a requirement that all students and staff wear masks as required by the Illinois Department of Public Health and the Illinois State Board of Education. We will also practice social distancing and limit student movement to reduce exposure. And very much like our schools as we have always imagined them to be, our focus will be on assessment-informed instruction that is aligned to critical learning standards. The second option parents will have will be to participate in full-time remote learning. Unlike last spring, we will have a more robust model of remote learning that will include a much more similar schedule to the in-person school day. Students will have daily live instruction from teachers, opportunities for small group instruction, and there will also be a focused assessment-informed instruction model that will be aligned to critical learning standards. We are requiring families who select a remote learning option for their students to commit to the first grading period, which in middle school would be the first quarter, and in elementary school would be the first trimester. Now I'm going to talk about how we will handle confirmed and suspected cases of COVID and how that will impact our models. As required by ISBE and IDPH, any individual who has been in close contact with a person who has tested positive for COVID-19 must self-quarantine for 14 days. Specifically, any individual required to quarantine during close contact will transition to a remote learning plan. So it's important to note that even if families select in-person learning for their students, we also have to recognize that due to COVID-19 response protocols, they may be required to engage in remote learning should there be a confirmed case or exposure to an individual with COVID. Families and staff will be asked to report possible cases to our school and district where individuals attend to help us engage in contact tracing. Nurses' offices will collect symptom reports when absences are reported, and 72 hours must elapse from a resolution of fever without fever-reducing medication, and 10 days must pass after symptoms first appeared prior to students' or staff's return. If a staff member or student is found to test positive for COVID, we will follow IDPH guidance regarding quarantine and up to the potential closure of a school. So here are the anticipated conditions we expect for this fall. We expect that students may move from in-person learning to remote learning for a period of time. We are committed for both in-person and remote experiences to provide similar expectations around coursework and grading. We anticipate that remote learning will follow the same schedule as in-person learning, and that in both of these models, we have a consistent goal for all students to feel safe, connected, and have access to high-quality learning. Now I'm going to talk about our special education considerations. Whether families select in-person learning or a remote learning option, they can count on collaborative IEP partnerships with their child's IEP teams. And just as we always do, IEP teams will collect data on students' current learning levels and unique needs to ensure that the IEP goals and supports are appropriate. 504 plans or IEPs may be reviewed on an individual basis should health and safety requirements be needed. And health and safety modifications across our special education programs may look different based on individual classroom or programmatic needs. But we want to emphasize to our families with children with IEPs and 504 plans that we are committed to collaboration and providing fully appropriate supports for your children. We also want to point out that whether your student participates in in-person or remote learning this fall, that we are focused on fostering empowered learners. Specifically, we will provide social-emotional learning supports for all children with an emphasis on connectedness, safety, and supportive relationships. Teachers will provide weekly SEL meetings with students to provide responsive supports and education, such as coping strategies and how to work through disappointing or unexpected situations, which has been very important for all of us to learn during this season. We also will be providing much instruction and support around technology for all District 57 children. All students from kindergarten through eighth grade will have their own Chromebook. We are able to use existing resources to provide these Chromebooks for children and did not require significant additional purchasing. Teachers will provide lessons to help students learn functioning skills for online learning, again, in recognition that even if children are in-person learning, we need to be prepared for a shift to remote learning. And teachers will be providing all children with instruction around using tech tools and solid digital citizenship so that we are fully preparing children to engage in an online environment with agency and skill. And also we need to provide really consistent and clear instruction around what classroom routines and daily expectations will look like, both in person and in a remote environment. Now I'm going to go in depth in what will be offered in our in-person learning model. Just as we had prior to schools closing last March, our full-time in-person learning model will focus on high-quality instruction aligned to critical learning standards. That won't change. But we do need to start with prioritizing what potential learning loss or even acceleration may need to occur as a result of the pandemic. We know that given that our children haven't been in school since last March, our staff will be anticipating potential gaps in learning compared to typical years, and we will provide comprehensive assessment plans to ensure that teachers have the most important data about their children to inform their instruction. We will also need to prioritize the most critical standards and prerequisite skills for each subject area and grade level to really ensure that instruction is aligned to the most critical learning and children are maximizing the time that they have available for learning. And we really will continue to use data to drive our instruction, which is a model that we use during any given year. As mentioned earlier, we will provide regular social emotional learning lessons for children. We are committed to restorative practices and believe fully that our students and staff need protected opportunities to develop relationships and feel connection to each other, to provide support and an environment where everyone can thrive. So we will be engaging in that work in in-person learning, although we will of course be adhering to social distancing in doing so. Our elementary music, art, and LRC skills lessons will be held in the general education classroom as opposed to students traveling to these environments in a typical year. For PE, we will be using our gyms, but when weather allows, PE will be held outside. And if weather does not allow or the PE gym is not available, the PE classes will be held in the classroom. We are determining what band will look like and can ensure that any recommendations will be aligned to the health and safety precautions by IDPH and ISBE. And there will be no field trips or assemblies due to the limitations of our current phase four in the Restore Illinois model that prohibits gatherings of 50 people or more. Meetings, professional development opportunities, and all of these types of activities will be held using an online video format. Now I'm going to introduce my colleague, Adam Parisi, the Assistant Superintendent for Finance and Operations, who will be talking about safety protocols for the in-person learning option.
Hello. Now I'm here to talk about a lot of the logistical things for in-person learning. As was mentioned before, going back to school is going to look very different than it did under a normal atmosphere. So first, we're going to talk about some arrival and dismissal procedures. And keep in mind, as we're going through these logistics, everything is going to be revolving around keeping our students safe and our staff members safe. So first of all, students will be kept 6 feet apart. It will take a number of minutes to get ourselves into school. We envision at the beginning of the school year, first day or so, that will take longer. And as that students and family members and staff members get used to the procedure, that time will speed up. There will be markings on the floors throughout the buildings to encourage that spacing to help with that arrival and keeping those kids apart. We're going to increase the use of our exterior doors so we can spread our students out. We can have many more entry points as far as moving students into the building and out of the building. And then importantly, when students first arrive to school, they're not going to be able to congregate in their groups. They're going to be let into school in their classes earlier than they normally would in a regular atmosphere. As we are well aware, recommendations from IDPH, CDC, all students and staff will be required to wear masks. For those of you that want to prepare your students for that and or children for that and practice prior to that, we encourage you to do so, but students will have to wear masks throughout the entire day. Desks will be spread apart, but in many cases, they will not be 6 feet. On the right here, you see an example of a typical classroom. And with that spacing, it looks a lot more than a traditional classroom setting. Classrooms are set up in rows. Desks are facing the front, where a teacher will be teaching from the front of the classroom. For those times that we have small group instruction, which we know is essential, we are purchasing plexiglass dividers to provide an extra barrier of safety for those staff and students. In addition to that, we are moving ahead and hiring additional daytime custodians. Their main responsibility will be additional sanitizing and cleaning throughout the building to help keep everyone safe. And finally, as part of those responsibilities of those daytime custodians, those high touch surface areas will get that extra attention in terms of disinfecting. When it comes to Westbrook, Fairview, and Lyons Park, we're making great efforts to keep the cohorts of students together to try to minimize that movement and to keep those students with their peers. An adjustment also will have some specials that are usually located in another classroom. Will now be that special teacher will be coming to the classroom to provide instruction to those students in that space. We're going to discourage shared supplies as much as possible. And again, this is going to be something at home that we're going to encourage parents to communicate to their students and children prior to coming to school. And then we want to take advantage of the nice weather, and we want to be able to go outside either for lunch or other classroom opportunities whenever weather permits. Lincoln, as we know, looks a lot different, but we are making some changes to try to, you know, make some of these adjustments. So the schedule will change a little bit, and the whole idea with that schedule changing is to minimize the movement of students throughout those hallways. Passing periods are going to be staggered to try to decrease that hall traffic. And then similar to the elementary buildings, we're going to encourage students to go outside as much as possible. Lunch, another area that's going to look very different. Many students will be eating in their classrooms. Now, you know that allergies, we take very serious in this district. And as a result of that, we will set up different areas so that students will get priority, whether that is in areas in the classroom or in the multi-purpose room or cafeterias. But we have plans developed in working with our nursing teams to ensure that that is part of our plan. And then in terms of Lincoln, the cafeteria will still be open. Food services will be provided. So any student that wants to come to Lincoln that wants to purchase food will still have the ability to do so. Much like our other schools, there will be some flexibility here into whether they are eating in the cafeteria or if they are eating in their classrooms, because as you know, we need to keep that cafeteria space less than 50. But cafeteria will be open and food will be able to be purchased there. We will be self-certifying to try to cut down on the time it takes for arrival and to kind of keep, you know, some accuracy as far as temperature readings are concerned. So parents are going to have to self-certify to mention that or to state that their students are symptom free. If students get sick during the during the school day, our nurses' offices will be able to assess their overall well-being. We're doing some changes not only in the regular nurse's office, but then adding a second office for kind of as an isolation room. The regular nurse's office plexiglass is being ordered and installed to kind of keep that barrier as an extra level of protection. And in addition to those four-day custodians to help on cleaning and sanitizing, we're also hiring four nurses' assistants to assist with sick student or sick staff and to make sure if those students move into that isolation room, we'll always have supervision in that area. In addition to that, the drinking fountains are spread out throughout the buildings. However, we are not going to have everyone drinking water from the fountain. We definitely don't want students or staff members putting their mouth in the fountain. However, the bottle refill stations are active, and so individuals can use their water bottles to be able to fill up with water so they can have that throughout the day. In terms of PPE, we need to understand that we're in a crisis. And being that we're in a crisis, this is a crisis budget. My team has been working with 30, 40 different companies and vendors to try to make sure not only that we can have appropriate amounts of PPE, but most importantly, so that it gets here on time. Right now, we're looking to spend between $500,000 to $750,000 on PPE. We realize that that is a ton of money. However, we also realize that student and staff safety is our highest priority here. So to be able to allocate those budget dollars for something as important as this is necessary. We have ordered face shields for some of our specialized personnel. We realized with that recent guidance that has come out on face shields, most people they just won't have the face shields. They'll still have a mask underneath the face shields, but they can have that face shield as an extra level of protection. We have ordered hundreds of gallons of hand sanitizer, and that will be spread out and spaced outside of each classroom. We're going to encourage hand sanitizing prior to coming into the classroom, and in some cases, coming into the building. We're ordering clear children's masks for those who need assistance with lip reading. And then we are also purchasing some N95 masks for specialized personnel. Other PPE and ways the schools are going to look a little different to keep everyone safe. I mentioned when we're looking at classrooms that we have plexiglass that is going to be put on those tables as an extra level of protection, both for small group instruction and in areas where classrooms no longer have desks and have tables, like primary grades over at Westbrook and science areas over at Lincoln. We have also purchased partitions to be placed in schools' offices so we can provide some protection between personnel that work there. Plexiglass is going to be put in school offices to provide that barrier between personnel and visitors, very similar to what you would see in a checkout line in a grocery store or place to pick up food, retail, very similar to something like that. Mentioned before that we have spots on the floor so that students know, try to keep that 6 feet whenever possible with that social distancing. We're also purchasing gowns for nurses and nurses' assistants. There will be a ton of signage in schools to reinforce some of these new measures that are put in place. They're not only are they posted outside on the doors, but they're also posted throughout the buildings. So one big thing is signage related to self-certifying. Need to make sure everyone's symptom-free, and there will be signage throughout the building to alert either visitors or volunteers before they enter the building, and as a reminder for staff and students as they're going about their everyday business. Hand washing is going to be highly encouraged throughout the day, and social distancing in hallways. And again, we have signage that will reflect that. I want to spend just a moment talking about transportation, because like the rest of our plan, transportation will look a little different. So all students on bus routes have to wear masks. That's from the moment they are standing on their bus stop to board the bus until the bus finishes and they, as part of dismissal, they leave the bus and are going home. Our bus company, First Student, we have an agreement with them. They're going to sanitize the buses prior to both the AM routes and the PM routes. The buses are keeping with phase four recommendations of gatherings are 50 or less. So our buses will have 50 or less people, including the bus driver and an occasional bus monitor. And then if for some reason students don't have their mask when they board the bus, because we know masks are crucial and necessary, masks will be made available for those individuals riding the bus. And now I'm going to send it back to Dr. Mary Gore, who's going to talk a little bit more in depth about the remote learning option.
Thanks, Adam. Now I'm going to talk more about the remote learning option. As I mentioned earlier, it's important to distinguish the remote learning option this year compared to the remote learning experience of last spring. As we know, the situation last spring was very challenging due to the lack of adequate time and resources to fully prepare for what turned into a long-term and emergency teaching situation. We did the best we could, but we fully acknowledge that that was not an ideal and sustainable model, and we have reflected on the feedback from our parents, our students, and our staff. And together, our task force has worked really hard to ensure that our remote learning plans for this fall are going to be much more robust and comprehensive to align to the needs of our children. So just as an overview, full-time remote learning is significant to know that it requires that parents opt out of the in-person learning experience. The deadline to enroll in this learning option will be July 27th. In order for us to have adequate planning and staff the full remote learning experience, we need enough time to ensure that all the details are worked out and all planning is viable and ready to go for the first day of school, August 20th. So it's critically important that families determine if this is going to be the best plan for their children and their families. What will full-time remote learning entail this fall? Well, our teachers will be prepared to deliver a guaranteed and viable virtual curriculum following a synchronous and asynchronous approach. Synchronous meaning live instruction, and asynchronous meaning recorded instruction that students can view at their leisure or during times that are most important and available to them. Our schedule for remote learning will provide students with portions of independent work time and also times for small group meetings with teachers, and even some one-on-one sessions with their teachers. We realize that in in-person learning, students have all of these options afforded to them, both whole group instruction, small group instruction, one-on-one instruction. And for that reason, we think it's essential that our virtual learning experience has this as well. We will align the remote learning program to the in-person learning through common resources, our digital platforms of Google Classroom or Seesaw, and of course have alignment to our grade level curriculum and the pacing that will be occurring for in-person instruction. There will be an emphasis on consistent teacher feedback and grading that is comparable to our in-person instruction model as well. We realized that this was a bit uneven last spring, and quality feedback is an essential component to any viable and comprehensive instructional model, so that will be a huge focus for us this year. We also realize that students are going to need social-emotional supports when they're in remote learning as well. So there will be weekly social-emotional lessons with the teacher where coping skills and pro-social skills will be addressed in the context of a strong and supportive learning community. It will be challenging, we think, for children to form strong relationships with their teachers and their classmates in the context of remote learning. And for that reason, we will put intentional and proactive plans in place to provide children with lots of opportunities to form those relationships just as they would in an in-person learning setting. We think it will be challenging, but we're up for the challenge. And we have a lot of great resources, both in our talented mental health staff of our social workers and our school psychologists, as well as our commitment as a district to have relationships be at the center of our work. That will not change if you choose a remote learning experience for your child. You can count on that being part of our program. We also will keep a commitment to assessments, which are so critical for us to understand what skills students have and what skills students need to be reinforced. And so we will engage in benchmark assessments in a remote context, just as we do in in-person learning every year. We also want to point out that this full-time remote learning option is likely one for students who have elevated health risks or for families who may have elevated health risks in their families. But we also are allowing parents of students who simply prefer that remote learning is the option that is the best fit for their family, that they are eligible to enroll in this. We're not putting any prerequisites or requiring parents to apply for the status. We are opening up remote learning to all of our families, again, with the request that there is a minimum commitment for one grading period in order for there to be viable and consistent plans and experiences for our children. I also want to point out that we were fortunate to receive money from the federal government through the CARES Elementary and Secondary School Emergency Relief Grant. We received approximately $77,000, which was used to purchase licenses for Zoom and other online resources such as Screencastify, which is a great tool for recording presentations like this one, and also Newzella for our Fairview, Lions Park, and Lincoln students, and many other subscriptions that really will make remote learning a more robust and comprehensive experience. Now I will be heading this back to my colleague Adam, who will be talking about the next steps for families.
All District 57 families are going to be required to submit a fall attendance plan form for every single student. On Friday, July 17th, a link will be emailed to all District 57 families. Please be sure to look out for that link. We are giving families 10 days to submit that form to be able to make a clear decision of what their intentions are for the fall. Monday, July 27th is when that deadline is to submit that form so that the administration can begin planning for the upcoming school year. So just recapping some of those important dates. Friday, July 17th is when the window opens for families to designate either in-person learning or remote learning. That will be part of that survey that's being sent out. The window will close on Monday, July 27th. on August the 12th, class placement and information will be sent out to parents. And as we know, the school district calendar has been adjusted slightly to now the first day of school being Thursday, August 20th. That's also the day of the Board of Education meeting. On behalf of Dr. Elaine Allmiller, Dr. Mary Gore, I would like to thank you for the time you spent watching our presentation. This has been a very important and crucial plan that we've spent a lot of time putting together. Wanted to listen to the feedback from families and be able to give families both options depending on what suits your child's needs. This survey, in addition to an FAQ, will be posted on the website, which will give you some further information. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Adam, Mary, and Elaine. That was a great presentation, very informative. And with all the questions that the community had, quite a few of them were answered with that presentation. So I thank you for that. And I'm going to open it up to you guys. I have questions, but I'll open up to you guys to see what questions you have that you think need to be answered, or something from the community comments that drew you to maybe want to ask that question yourself. So I don't know who wants to. John, you have, go ahead.
Yeah, just two questions I had. One, I think one of the parents had stated, or maybe it was a teacher in the community comments, about all of them in a classroom eating at the same time. So I understand the capacity limit in the lunchroom. A lot of the lunch will now occur in a classroom. Obviously, you have to take off a mask to do so. So is that going to be staggered in any way, or do we feel like that based on the classroom size, that they could take off their mask and all eat at the same time?
Based on what we have to offer as far as spacing, we think we're following guidelines by having them all eat at one time.
Okay. And then the second question was more just from staffing perspective. So obviously you went through the criteria, if there's any symptoms, when you need to quarantine. How does it work with substitutes? So I know obviously we're always looking for substitutes just as a resource in general. Is there anything similar? Is there any kind of, if somebody comes into the classroom and then maybe they're just there for one day and a few days later they have COVID, like is there any kind of requirements with our substitutes? Like how does that work?
Well, we're still working out details regarding substitutes. There's still a lot of questions to be answered, and to be quite honest, I really can't answer that for you at this point in time.
Okay. But no guidance, I guess, from like ISB or anything else regarding that?
Not at this time, no.
Okay.
We're waiting for more guidance to be coming from Illinois Department of Health. Sarah, did you want to address that?
So I can say specifically if it's staff member or student test positive, that is something that was not within the guidance that ISB and Department of Health released to us. So I've been in contact with the Department of Health, our regional office here in Cook County, and also our regional Board of Education has been in contact with them and pulling a whole bunch of questions from surrounding districts who have the same questions we all have. So they're planning to do a webinar within the next couple weeks. So it has not been scheduled yet, but hopefully we'll have some more answers regarding what to do when positive tests occur. But we'd be following Department of Health guidance in that instance.
Okay, thank you.
A couple questions.
Just one, hold on. I'm just going to ask one quick just to back up on Jen's. So really, an IDPH puts out something in regards to all the whether someone tests positive and then what happens with that, with quarantining and how many people might be affected by it and then them coming back. Is that correct? That was for
Sarah. Yes. Yes, so we're looking for that guidance right now to what specific information as far as how many people have to quarantine and all that information.
Okay, so we don't have that specifically yet. Okay, thank you. Brian, you can go ahead.
Well, thank you, Dr. Allmiller and Adam and Mary and your team and Sarah for working so hard and preparing us the best we can for the school year. I have a few questions. First question is, was a hybrid model considered? And if so, why was it rejected?
The area superintendents, all of the superintendents are from District 211 and its center schools and District 214 and its center schools. We have all been meeting twice a week since this whole thing started back in March. And as it approached the time that we were going to get guidance from ISB on the reopening of school, we all determined that a hybrid model really wasn't in the best interest for two reasons. One, it's a real burden on the teaching staff. And I'm not sure that those that recommended a hybrid model really realize what it would mean for them, because they have to be teaching not only the students in their classroom live, but at the same time, they have to be synchronously instructing the class members that are at home, because you get half of your class members Monday and Tuesday, you get the other half of them Thursday and Friday, but you're still teaching them all week long. And that is a real burden on teachers to be able to be teaching in person and be synchronously teaching as well. So that was one consideration. The other consideration is regards to our working families. Because if you do a hybrid model, you are really putting it to the working families, because they now have to provide childcare 3 days a week. And they need us to be open. And so all of the superintendents, we really felt that it was, the guidance we were getting was, they wanted us to be open every child, every day to the best of our ability. So that's the position that we all took. And that's why we're all doing this. We're all in-person learning and remote learning option at this point in time.
Could we consider a model in which students, you don't have to send necessarily a hybrid, but a student could do both. So a student could elect to a Monday and Tuesday go to school in person and then the rest of the week stay at home. Is that something we could consider?
I think the logistics of giving that degree of an option would be a staffing nightmare. The staffing is really at the crux of all of these options. And without providing additional staffing, and we just don't have the financial resources to increase our staffing, I'm not sure any district really does. So that's not something that we really talked about.
You earlier mentioned that it would be, the hybrid model would be challenging for teachers because they would have to be teaching the students live and also teaching the students remotely. But aren't they going to be doing that under this plan?
No, the remote learning will be done by a certain group of teachers. The in-class learning will be by other teachers.
Oh, okay.
So that's why we need parents to commit to which of the two models they're going to take, because we need to know how many teachers we're going to have to pull from our teaching staff to do the remote teaching option.
Logistically, we can't have some sort of technology that's video feed from a classroom into, so the students can attend or participate in the classroom that way. That's not possible?
I'm not sure that we've got the financial resources to invest in that. I know that the high school is looking to do something like that, but for us, that would be a huge financial commitment.
Okay. And just to make a comment to what Brian just said, the Prospect D4214 sent out an email just recently before this meeting, and I couldn't understand quite everything that was in there, but they were saying something about having the feed in the classroom so that if kids were not in the classroom, they would have the same experience and that extent of kids that were there because they were getting it also. So that is a curious point to see if, even if that's possible, cost on something like that down the road, or even, you know, sooner than that.
Just one last question.
Go ahead.
Yeah. What if 50% of the students opted for remote learning? Are we equipped to handle that?
I believe that we are. We really don't have a threshold of how many is too many or how many is too few. We really haven't determined a threshold along those lines.
Okay.
Okay, Vicki, go ahead.
Yes. So I just want to thank, or, you know, echo everyone's thanks to Dr. Allmiller, Mary, and Adam. And I also wanted to thank, so many parents and teachers who took the time to write to us. I think our whole board is so grateful to you. Your letters were very powerful, so thank you for sending those in. I have to say, I was really surprised by some of the letters that we received from the teachers. Obviously, I could, sort of imagine, what they could feel or, try to put myself in their shoes, but it was entirely different to hear those letters written from them. So I guess I was wondering if maybe Dr. Allmiller, you could talk a little bit about, some of those conversations that you've had. I know you've been in very close contact with MPA, MPESPA, the task force. Will teachers, a lot of them expressed a desire either for hybrid or for remote, actually. So will a lot of do teachers, can they self-choose if they want to do remote or?
Oh, sure. They're going, while the video was playing, I just sent out an email to all the staff and there's a survey on there for them to let us know their preferences, if they would be want to do one more than the other. One thing they have to realize is if they're interested in doing remote, it may not be the same grade level that they're currently teaching. It just depends what age students, what the numbers are, how they come in as far as how we have to staff it. But we're seeking that information from them. Actually, right now, the survey's in their hands. And we've given them until July 27th as well to let us know.
Okay. I guess, it just happened that all the feedback that I received tonight from teachers and staff were very much in favor of a more remote learning model. But have you heard anything where teachers expressed the opposite? Or I guess I don't know if I'm just more interested.
We've been in very close contact with the MPA leadership. We have weekly meetings with them, and they have been very supportive. And they're anxious to go back. So they know you're not going to please everybody. We know that. But the information, the conversations that we've had with MP leadership, the staff are ready to go back. So that's all I can tell you, is that hasn't come out of our meetings with them, that there's this groundswell of discontent about going back. At least we haven't heard that at this point.
Okay. Jerry, go ahead.
Just like everybody else, thank you very much. I thought the plan was actually very thoughtfully put together, and very thorough. I guess one question that stuck out to me between the questions or the comments from some of the teachers versus the plan was, in the plan, there's the ability to provide N95 masks and face shields to some teachers. Given some of the concerns, would we actually be able to provide those options to all of our teachers? What would be the constraint? Is it availability or financial that might allow us to do something like that?
Availability, but Adam, I'll let you talk to that because you're the one purchasing.
As alluded to, we've worked very hard to do the purchasing, and if the staff members, for the staff members that wanted them, we would be able to get either N95 masks or face shields or both. We have new orders coming in every single day. New supplies are being ordered and coming in. So that is a possibility.
Okay, so that might address some of the, if we are put in the position of, depending on where the governor goes, that we could actually provide an enhanced level of safety for some teachers, that especially if they're in high-risk groups.
Definitely.
Okay. My second question was to Eileen. Could you reread all the letters?
Did I what?
Could you reread all
them?
You know what? There's going to be a later edition tonight. That's when you just a soft read, a little light music.
the meeting's being recorded. It'll be on the website tomorrow. Jerry, you can listen to it again.
All right.
There you go. There you go. Over and over. Hit replay. All right. Rachel, did you have anything?
Yes. I have a few questions. And again, thanks to everybody who has participated in this. I know this is a situation that none of us want to be in. And I feel like there are no perfect decisions at this point. I had a few questions regarding a couple of the points from the presentation and Lincoln. Because one of the points said that social distancing and limited student movement will be employed. And I think that's easier for myself and probably other parents to imagine at like Westbrook, Lions Park, and Fairview, where we know that the classes are generally contained during the day. But can anyone kind of expound on like what limited student movement will look like at Lincoln? Like, will they be changing classes and just be staggered, or will they stay with a kind of a cohort group there?
It would be a combination of both. There are some things you can do to the schedule that can keep them together in the classroom, dealing with their LA classrooms and their science classrooms and their social studies, and you can limit the movement that way. But there are other classes that there's just no other way around it. They would have to move. So there would be limited movement. It wouldn't be the same schedule that they run on a typical day. So there would be limited movement. And then they would stagger the transition periods so that there are fewer kids out in the hallways at the time. And a transition period takes 3 to 4 minutes.
Okay, so we're anticipating that during all of those transitions, though, that they would not be with a group of larger than 50, based on like the staggering of how that's going to be.
I'm not sure I can say that. I'm not sure that I can say it would be a limited of 50. You know, we'll try to do the best we can, but I can't honestly say that.
Okay. Another question regarding Lincoln. Can someone just talk a little bit about why? Why we decided to keep the cafeteria open and not go to like a brown bag lunch distribution or something. It just seems like that might be another, everything I guess revolving around lunch and eating seems like it could be a possible challenge in terms of being, maskless and stuff. I don't know, can anyone share the conversation around keeping the purchasing of food open? Mm-hmm.
I will direct that to Adam.
Yes, just having the students who are either receiving, who are on free lunch or who, purchase lunch would have the ability to make those purchases and get those foods. Now, with that being said, the cafeteria food service line will look a lot different. There will not be open salad bars. There will not be open deli bars. Everything will be prepackaged, where students will essentially go and pick it up and either go back to their classroom or go to a part in the cafeteria where they're spread out. So as far as the food substance itself, it will be much more contained. But we want to be able to give those students on both ends those options.
Okay. And I wonder in that case, if students are basically eating in their classrooms, if there is a way to somehow distribute those prepackaged meals. It just seems like a lot of extra student movement for something that isn't instructionally important. Mm-hmm. But that's just 2 cents on that.
Thank you.
In terms of, I guess with in terms of bathrooms, so thinking about bathrooms, because I know that there is concern, like especially with like aerosol, the virus being potentially aerosoled in a bathroom and in toilets like where there are no lids, which I think is the majority of our school bathrooms. Like, will bathrooms be monitored at all during like passing periods? Because I'm just thinking of, you know, I'm assuming that at Lincoln they are mostly that students are, they go on their own during passing periods. And I wonder just about those, because those are very small enclosed spaces. And I think it's difficult to social distance in there. And if we're encouraging increased hand washing, I just wonder, will the schedule be adapted that is included as part of like class time or as part of passing time? Or I know it's kind of an odd question, but I just see that as an area. And I can speak at least for the school where I work. I mean, the bathrooms are crowded, and that would be an area of high transmission.
I won't pretend to know how they're going to do it at the middle school. I'll just tell you that Paul Siminski is working on that, so okay, that we can limit the occupation of the bathrooms as much as possible.
Okay. And my final question, I guess, is somewhat related. Is there any information to share about the staffing or the social distancing measures that will be taken at Kids Corner in any of the buildings?
Adam, you want to take Kids Corner?
So because of the Kids Corner space, the space will be limited to 50 or less, including the supervisors. And much of the parameters that we're going to put either around recess or PE classes will apply to Kids Corner as far as games and equipment, and try to, you know, limit the use of that and sanitize that as much as we can. So to that point, Kids Corner from an activity level will look a lot different than it has in the past few years.
Okay. And I know sometimes Kids Corner is forced to just occupy like the small Kids Corner rooms rather than having access to the gyms. And I'm assuming just because of other limitations on activities that they should have access to the gyms every day, right? Just so they can social distance. Cause I can't imagine in those small rooms that with 50 people, there would be any distance at all.
Right. You wouldn't be able to do that in with things like, reasons for displacements, mm-hmm. things like holiday concerts and practicing for that, you know, that will look very different. So those situations where the students would be removed from Kids Corner will not be happening on as frequent basis, if at all.
Okay. And I know that it went out for parents to register for Kids Corner at the beginning of August. Are we assuming that there will be any kind of lottery, or is it a first come first serve if there are more than 50? We were at more than 50 at some schools last mm-hmm. year.
Yeah, the way it's going to be set up through the online community pass system will be, you know, basically a first come first serve. So we're going to communicate the date and the time Monday, August 3rd, 8 a.m. And people can all log on, and the first, you know, 47 or so that get in.
Okay. And my final question. One of the parent letters had asked how families would be notified, like if they would be given, you know, details about the possible exposure of their kids. Do we have any guidance from like ISB or the Illinois Department of Public Health about notifications? Are there HIPAA rules that come into play with that?
Sarah?
Yes, so we would definitely follow the guidance of Department of Health when we have an exposure within our buildings. We do intend to notify the entire building that there has been an exposure within the building, so parents are aware, and provide a little more specific information to those students who have come in contact with that student, if they're in the same classroom or what have you. But as far as any identifying information, that would not be provided. So we would still keep that confidential.
Okay, thank you. Thanks.
Okay. Kim, did you have anything?
I do. I have several more questions. I hope you're okay with me.
Go ahead.
I of course want to echo the thanks that's been presented to all of you that have been working so hard to put these plans together.
as things are changing day to day, and we're trying to come up with just the best of two worst scenarios. I just really appreciate all of the effort that you all have put into putting these plans together. I have a couple of questions. My first, with regard to e-learning, I know several of the community comments raised the question around, you know, if a teacher gets sick and the class needs a sub, if they're doing in-person learning, what does that look like? I have a similar question with regard to e-learning. To the degree a teacher gets sick who's leading an e-learning cohort, what are the options then for the students that are in that class?
Mary, you want to field that? You're muted, Mary.
My children are sleeping now, so it's safe to unmute. I spared a lot of screaming from this meeting by muting myself. The simple answer to that is it's going to be very tricky, all of the logistics around subbing. And I think many of us, you know, it's worth stating, even in our best years, we struggle with subs. And those are years in the building. So we're the first to acknowledge that this situation is nerve-wracking for us as we think about how we're going to be prepared and have really flexible and adaptive plans around last-minute replacements of teachers in a short-term or long-term basis. And it's going to be extremely challenging. So a couple things we're thinking about, as you know, if you took the parent survey that we've already done, we've done some recruitment efforts to try to increase our sub pools, to try to really make sure that we're growing the, you know, the available resources we have right here in our community. But in terms of the specific question about the protocol, we're still going to need to work through that. And similar to all of our planning, we have the benefit of not being unique in this challenge. So we're working very collaboratively with local districts to try to put our heads together and think what makes the most sense, what's good for kids, what's good for teachers, what's sustainable. So all of those things are going through our mind. But in terms of the specific plan to roll out, I don't think we could answer it yet. But we're gonna have to be really adaptable and nimble is, you know, the traits that are gonna have the highest priority for us.
Yeah, I mean, it stands to reason, right? A lot of the concern that was expressed was about potential exposure within the school. But of course, we all risk exposure just by going about our daily lives. And so even to the degree a teacher is teaching exclusively remotely, there's still a chance that he or she could become ill with the virus or with something else. And so I was curious to know, obviously, it's impossible to plan for every detail, every contingency. The one thought I had, if it's at all helpful, is given the capacity of some of these virtual platforms, I wondered whether it would be possible for the students who are affected by an ill teacher to maybe join a different section of their same grade, you know, and so it might be a week or so that one teacher is teaching 50 kids instead of only 25. Maybe that would help to maintain continuity of learning for the students. And also be able to accommodate then the reality of the substitute shortage in addition to that particular teacher being able to recover and recuperate. So that's just my two cents. Obviously, you all can speak better to whether that's a realistic ability or not. With regard to lunchtime and the concerns that were expressed around having students all unmasked at the same time and eating and the risks of that. It raised a question, first of all, in my mind of really what are we talking about in terms of the capacity of these classrooms? You know, is the concern for the risk of lunchtime in the classroom, are we contemplating that risk thinking of a 25 to 27 student classroom? Or is the idea that we anticipate that families will opt into the remote option, thereby reducing the class size for in-person. And so whoever is left in that in-person class, it might be 20, 10, whatever that looks like. I just wonder to what degree the perceived risk is mitigated by the extent to which we actually can maintain social distancing guidelines within a classroom based on how many people have opted into remote learning. I don't know if anybody can speak to that, if that's been intelligible at all.
Well, the unknown there is how many are going to opt out for remote learning. And that's why we need to know that number. If you take the survey, the initial survey that we put out, there were 41% that expressed an interest in it. That has a significant impact on the number of kids in a classroom. So that would essentially help to mitigate that risk in and of itself. But again, it's an unknown until we can get some numbers from parents.
Sure. But I guess the crux of my question is there any intention or effort being made to reduce class sizes, e-learning, remote learning notwithstanding? Do we have any capacity at all instead of 27, 25 to bring classes down to 20 and create new sections to accommodate additional spacing?
Not okay. To my knowledge, no.
Okay.
The simple answer to that is no.
Sure. And assuming then, and I don't know if we have the numbers immediately available, assuming that the 41% who indicated an interest actually, what does that leave us as far as the remaining population in, you know, maybe that's too complicated of a question to answer right now, but across the schools, the remainder, the 41% aside who's going to remote learn, do we have a sense of what that would look like per classroom? I know it depends by school too.
Yeah, we really don't, because you don't know if that 41% that expressed an interest was really concentrated in the primary grades, if it was spread across the grades evenly. There's just no way to know that distribution.
Okay. Okay. I mean, I appreciate, Dr. Oller, you clarifying what the... is what the vision was for this idea of a hybrid structure of like an A-B schedule or something like that. I guess I didn't realize it was contemplated to mean the teacher is live in person while students are also watching live online. Mm-hmm. Certainly I can understand how burdensome that would be. I also think it diminishes the opportunity for the teacher to engage with those students who are remote in that context, right? Mm-hmm. That he or she only can.
I think just by the nature of a classroom, you're going to have more attention to those that you're in person with than those that are remote. I just think it's
right.
The beast.
Yeah. I mean, I guess the one way that a hybrid approach makes more sense to me is for to be live in person for half the class, recorded material for the half that's home that day, and then vice versa, you know, on the off days. I think that's how I understood it at first. But that being said, I think the hybrid model presents a lot of challenges that maybe haven't been considered. You know, some that came to mind for me would be the degree of cleaning involved between classes. You know, I think it was class A on Tuesdays and Thursdays, class B on Wednesdays and Fridays. That's less of an issue, but if we were to do an AM PM kind of a thing, and one of the kids in the AM class ended up sick, and you know, just see that as a total disaster. Not to mention, I think it still risks exposure for the teacher, who's going to be exposed to, you know. Well, I guess it would be the same amount of kids over the course of the week. So it seems safer for the students who are participating in that context to be in a smaller group, but the teacher is still exposed then to twice the amount of students. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It just feels riskier to me. So I appreciate that you all took the time to distill the option down to the two that seemed most viable. I am curious, though, I echo
Vicki's kind of concern and surprise about some of the teacher responses. And I wonder if maybe you could speak further about the goals and the purpose of the task force. Was it meant to just be advisory? Because I guess I imagined, I was surprised to know that many of them had expressed that they had no knowledge of the plan before it was being presented.
I will ask Mary and Adam, because they're facilitating the task force, if they'd like to address it, because I think they were surprised by some of those comments as well.
Okay.
Yeah, I can speak for the task force groups that I work with. You know, I can say that they have been a wonderful representative group of certified and more recently non-certified employees who, you know, come together. It's a large group because we want to make sure that we have representation from each grade level, each, you know, related services team. So it's large, but one of the challenges that we have in having collaboration is that we really believe strongly that if we're going to be involving our employees, that we need to pay them. And so we want to be really strategic in the use of their summer time. And also we have a limited number of resources that we can afford to do, you know, 50 hours of work or 100 hours of work. You know, we aren't in that position. So we've tried to really do a lot of intentional planning prior to the gatherings of these representative groups and try to articulate areas where administration has said, you know, here are some of the limits to plans, or here is what we believe to be viable based on these, you know, variables, and really try to be transparent and honest about, like, here's where we really need to keep working on this. And as it relates to not being aware of the remote learning plan or the plan that was being prepared tonight, we made the decision that tonight the board meeting would be the time that we rolled out this plan to the board, and that we didn't do these presentations for our staff, although the content of the presentation was generated through many iterations and of feedback and conversations. So I think I'd like to distinguish that I make that distinction. You know, the presentation itself was not viewed, but we were communicative to staff that there was intentional reasoning to use this board meeting as the official presentation to the board, the community, and to our staff, knowing that all these stakeholders work, you know, interwoven in their work. So I would just offer that. But I think in full disclosure, you know, our remote learning plan, we're actively meeting and working and refining what it's going to look like, where it doesn't work, where it could be better. All of this takes a lot of rounds and a lot of input. And our preschool teachers, our eighth grade teachers, everyone in the middle, there's a lot of different lenses and concerns or different perspectives that any gathering of people are going to have, even if it's five teachers. So we really want to honor the richness of that conversation and that input, but it does make the efficiency and perhaps the feeling of I'm sitting in every decision, I can understand why that can be frustrating. But there have been some challenges in the way that, you know, we're making hundreds of hours of decisions.
I want to give Mary credit for something here. Mary came to me and wanted to give the presentation to the staff ahead of the board, out of respect for the staff. So to her credit, that's where her thinking was. I said no, because to me, this is most important, needs to be rolled out to the board first. Mm-hmm. So if there's any criticism along those lines, it comes to me, because that was my call.
Sure. No, I understand both those perspectives. And Mary, I can understand your point too of, you know, ultimately staff has been informed of the totality of the plan, maybe just not in the same package that presented tonight. Mm-hmm. So I appreciate you clarifying that. I think my last question, hopefully my last question for all of our sake, is when you presented the options for in-person and remote learning contained a component where everybody who opts into that plan would be, would have access to a Chromebook, one-to-one Chromebook. To the degree we are mandated to go to complete remote learning, no in-person option, is that still a possibility? All of the students in the district with that material?
Yes.
Okay.
In fact, that will be everyone, whether they're in person or remote, we will have one-to-one Chromebooks for everybody for that very reason.
Mm-hmm.
Gotcha. That's great.
Okay. Can I ask one follow-up about the professional development that Mary had touched on?
Go ahead.
I can wait too. Okay.
No, go ahead.
You know, I think we all admit to some extent that there is a likely possibility that at some point during the year, perhaps all of our students will be remote learning. And that, who knows, even with the announcement tomorrow, if that could happen sooner rather than later. I guess my fear is that just out of necessity, we have concentrated so much time and effort on all of the safety protocols and the logistics of going back to the in-person. And then if at some point we are forced, all of us, back into the remote learning, that we may find ourselves like back on our heels again, not in the same situation, but with repeating feelings of what we had in March, where it was that everyone felt really thrown into it. Has there been could there be, prior to the beginning of school, I guess, either voluntary or some paid professional development for all of our teachers, the ones who are going to be teaching remote learning and the ones in the classroom potentially, to organize their curriculum around the e-learning model in the case that we may all go there at some point, and to do that in a robust, you know, organized way and be prepared for it prior to it happening?
Mary, go for it.
Yeah. In fact, I'll be meeting with the instructional technology coaches at noon tomorrow about to, you know, finalize what is going to be the biggest priority for our remaining days prior to the year, and also to make sure that professional development is carefully embedded throughout the year, that we're not just looking at the beginning of the year as the finish line, that we want to, of course, prioritize and make available as much learning as possible. And we're fortunate to have such a professional and, you know, committed district of teachers who are just eager to get as much training as possible. So we really want to provide that for them. A couple things that we intend to do is, because we've made decisions around specific technology purchases to make remote learning more robust, and also for that matter, in-person learning, because students will have Chromebooks, and we want to take advantage of in-person training with their teacher in the room to make sure that should we need to transition to remote learning, we are empowering our youngest learners to be more independent with how to navigate a Chromebook, how to log in, how to use Seesaw, how to submit an assignment, how to see that my teacher gave me feedback. We know from our focus groups that was a big issue, especially with our elementary and our primary children last spring, because we weren't a one-to-one district. Though teachers may have been giving feedback on Google Classroom on assignments, there was no knowledge from the child or the parents, for that matter, that anyone had ever even read their child's assignment. And many parents in the focus groups that Dr. Allmiller and I attended that said it wasn't until the very end that they realized in horror that there had been all this feedback in assignments, that it was for no good, right? And so I think like those are the types of things that we can learn from and really try to get in front of. So we have a lot of exciting, you know, tech and online subscriptions that we've used CARES Act money for from the federal government, which is entirely for this type of purchasing to enable powerful remote learning access for all students. So yeah, professional development will be coming along and continuing throughout the year, and we'll take the highest priority over what else we would be doing. So.
And I know, so I guess the other factor of that is the comfort level of parents with many of these tools that they may be kind of teaching at some point potentially. I mean, I was so impressed last year with the several kind of workshops that the instructional technology coaches did. And I don't want to put one more thing on their plate.
They've already learned to do it.
But there, yeah, I mean, I think any education that we can provide either by Zoom or with YouTube videos to the parents is going to make everyone feel better and more prepared. So thank you.
and you read their mind, because they've already at our task force meeting today said we really want to offer parent academies, and there's a desire mm-hmm. to really provide more support and more systematic partnership, because we all are so interdependent in this moment and making this right for our kids. So yeah, that's very aligned to what the conversations we're having on our task force.
Well, I will look forward to attending. Thank you, Eileen.
May I point out one more thing that we didn't talk about in the presentation, but I think it falls in this vein, and I think it's important to highlight to parents that are attending. Another important contribution of the task force is directly from our teachers wanting to meet with children prior to the beginning of the school year and initiating a Meet the Teacher event via Zoom, where whether the children are remote or going to be in-person learning, they will have information about when they can log in and get to know their teacher and, you know, just see their smiling face without a mask. And that those are the types of places where our teachers' hearts are at. They're mm-hmm. very concerned about those barriers, even in the way that they can give convey safety and warmth across, you know, the screen or behind the mask. So that's just yet another example that's really driven from our staff. And I want to highlight them and applaud them for their work.
Thank you. Go ahead, Jerry.
I had just two quick follow-up questions. One, in the online world, do you envision that teachers can actually handle a larger class size, or would it be the same sort of limits that we have on the in-person class sizes?
I think you would be limited by the nature of their contract specifying class sizes.
Okay. Okay. So that I think that addresses the other question that came up earlier, that in terms of the in-person, I think mathematically the classrooms will probably be equally as full as they are today if 40% of our teachers have to go over and teach online. We'll only have, they'll be proportionate to the stat, where the students go. So I think as far as spreading students out, I don't know that that'll be much, there much we could do physically. And the other was actually on the, if we do end up flipped either tomorrow or some future date by the governor to an all online learning, would there be a possibility that, you know, if we have the teachers that seem to express a preference for the online learning, to essentially put them in the driver's seat of more of the online learning development and the other basically by subject area, and have the other teachers essentially more in the background in terms of grading or, you know, monitoring, so that all of our teachers aren't trying to catch up and go to the online world if they're, one, if they're not as comfortable with it, and two, if they have a shorter time period. Would that be a logical way to go, where, you know, you have three Spanish teachers and one is an one's a great online learning person, you know, math, science, whatever. Does that make sense, or does that disconnect things for too much for the teachers who aren't online?
That's an interesting scenario. And what I would say to that is that if there are teachers who are interested in teaming up along those lines to capitalize on their strengths and each of their strengths, we would certainly be open to them doing that. I don't think it would be something that we would mandate. I think we'd be treading on some pretty shaky ground to mandate something like that.
Okay.
We'd be open to it.
Okay.
Okay.
That's all I need. Thank you.
Okay. All right. I'm going to ask a few questions. A lot of you have asked my questions and my follow-up, so I appreciate that. And some questions really can't be asked yet because you don't have the information. But I do want to know regarding, let's say, self-screening. When, since the parents would be doing this, is it a form that they fill out and turn in every day? Is it an app, or is it an online form like the Google form for attendance that they fill in and send in every day before they come to school?
It's actually, it's none of the above. but what self-certification would look like is that there would be a couple of things. One, there would be significant signage around the building saying that if you're entering this building, you're self-certifying that you're symptom-free. So it's a significant amount of signage around the building. And then the other thing is we would be communicating out via our weekly newsletters, giving a reminder to parents that remember that by sending your child to school, you are self-certifying that they're symptom-free.
Okay, so there is no form, no nothing like that at all?
No.
Okay. Okay, that's interesting. Only because, you know, when you go to the doctor's office, the dentist, and all these places, you know, they ask these certain questions, and then...
We talked about it, and we talked about it at length, but what we keep coming up to, the brick wall we keep coming up to, is the logistics of the process.
Right.
If you do a form every day, it's going to be on the backs of the classroom teacher to monitor that.
Okay.
I know that the high school district 214 is looking at some kind of an app for their purposes, but the rest of the elementary districts at this point are just doing a self-certification process.
Okay. And also, this is in regards to kind of testing in a way, but not necessarily. If we didn't reach phase three and we weren't completely remote learning, how many positive cases must we have in order for us to go to remote learning? Like, has that been discussed, or is that part of IDPH and you're still waiting for them?
Sarah, wanna?
Yeah, so we don't have specifics on what number would potentially shut down a classroom or a building. That's information that we would definitely take guidance from Department of Health, and they would work with us to do contact tracing and see how widespread infections might be.
Okay. Next up, there, just from some community questions that were kind of in there that, you know, might not have been addressed, but even though the CARES Act one was addressed during the presentation even, with regards to that $77,000, is there any extra money that is going to be given from that at all that you know of?
Not, Mary?
The only thing that would result in extra money is if the U.S. Department of Education declares that our non-public schools allocations will be allocated by their low-income students versus by their total enrollment students. So right now we have about $20,000 in a hold account as required by the federal government until the U.S. Department of Education makes their determination.
Okay.
So that could change how we're able to use $20,000 to do more purchasing.
Okay. And there's this HEROES Act that is coming down the pipe. I know it passed in the House, but who knows how it's going to happen in the Senate and how much money might actually be taken back out of it in order to pass the Senate. And then that could be additional money we could potentially get from another act from Congress in regards to getting money for the school. Potentially.
Awesome.
Some other questions that they had in regards to like the HVAC system, filtrating and just filtering and sanitizing the air. Is there any talk of, you know, do we have systems like that? Do systems like that work? Do you guys know anything about that?
Adam?
Mm-hmm. Yes, the air will be circulated more. The filters will be changed more often. We met with the HVAC company yesterday to be proactive to take some of these measures in place. So yes, yes, and yes.
Okay, awesome. Let's see. Okay, and some people have questions. I don't know if this is also in regards to with IDPH or not, that we don't know guidelines yet. Kids who do have symptoms that are COVID-like but are not COVID, and because if they're not getting tested or aren't able, whatever that might be, are those kids who have symptoms but do not have it, do they have to stay away, or do we not know yet?
So as the guidance currently stands, it appears that we would have to isolate those children as well. So we are looking for clarification about that, just because that does not seem realistic or fair if there's other things that are going on within that child's life. But we are looking for clarification from the Department of Health.
Okay. Also, for enrollment for the start of the school year anyway, what do you have any ideas on the numbers that we have for enrollment as of now before we start asking about whether we want to do in school or remote learning?
No,
do we have those numbers?
I don't have any enrollment numbers at this point. We just rolled over PowerSchool, and that's the first thing we have to do before we can start getting enrollment numbers.
Okay. Another question was, like, partitions. You are talking about putting partitions on the tables for, like, small group interaction. Is there any way to look into partitions around school desks? Is that a possibility to have that kind of separation if you can't do the 6 feet in the classroom?
We did not look at having partitions around every single desk. What we did, we're spreading the desks apart as much as we can, and then we're purchasing those plexiglass partitions similar to what you see in any kind of store or restaurant that you've been into, in between the student and the student, and then the student and the teacher, for all the guided reading tables and any other table where students are sitting right next to each other.
Okay. Is there any way we could see what cost would be with that? I mean, it seems like a massive scale, and
it would be a massive cost, but it's more about production and being able to get that here in the amount of time. I mentioned in the video that, you know, we've been in contact with probably 30 or 40 different vendors. Respectfully, they, you know, overpromise and underdeliver. Things are on back order, and it's very hard to get a lot of things. So we're able to get what we were able to get come in by, you know, the first week of August to be able to put in an order and get that stuff here by the beginning of school, frankly, is probably impossible.
If, you know, we do go to this remote learning and, you know, the governor decides that what we're going to do, if at any point in the future it shifts back to where we might be able to do half and half if we're not at phase five yet, can we look into it at least to see if that's a possibility for if we at least are remote and then we're back at this point again, and at least if we can look into something like that to being part of it. And also if we had the in-school and remote, I know that classrooms would potentially still be the same size because you have to still have staff doing the remote and staff doing in person. But during lunch period, would you be able to use then those other classrooms and then have the sanitation after they're done eating lunch, where you have, you know, fewer kids in each classroom because you're, depending of course on how many kids you have for remote and in person, to spread them out even at least during the lower period or lunch, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, one thing I will say, the building principals are on top of this. Any ways that they can spread the kids out, they are looking for ways to do that.
Okay.
So they would be looking to do such as that if the space was available.
Okay, that's great. I want to thank everybody for all the hard work that they've done, and the parents and staff and the community. We respect everybody's views, and everybody has their individual decisions as parents and how this is going to affect them. And we appreciate everybody recognizing how difficult these decisions are, and thank you for all your valuable input and for everything that you have put forward for us tonight. So appreciate that.
Thank you very much for your support. It means a great deal.
Okay. One question, Adam. Do you have Clorox wipes?
Yes.
I shouldn't have asked that. Now people are going to be looking for it. All right.
Key. I can't tell. Undisclosed location.
All right. We are going to continue on now, and we're going to do the prevention and response to bullying, intimidation, and harassment.
Sarah?
Okay, so I'm going to screen share so you can all see the presentation. All right, so thank you all for staying with me. I know it's already been a long meeting so far, but I appreciate your attention to this. So I'm here tonight to talk about Board Policy 7180, and it requires that the board review certain aspects of the policy on an annual basis regarding prevention of and response to bullying, intimidation, and harassment. So in review of this policy, I use the Parent Teacher Behavioral Advisory Committee to make sure that our practices aligned with this policy. It was the obvious group since they look at behavior generally across the district, so bullying being a behavior that we need to address. So the board required to evaluate and assess the following outcomes and their effectiveness. Now, we're going to look at over all of these different aspects of the data, and more specifics will be provided in each area. But I will say the first two are things that we had to make changes in our practices in order to make sure we had good alignment with our policy. And the final three are related to if a specific instance of bullying does occur. I just wanted to start first with what bullying is. So we use ALBAIS as our anti-bullying and bullying prevention program. Their definition is very short and sweet. Bullying is when someone repeatedly and on purpose says or does mean or hurtful things to another person who has a hard time defending himself or herself. So this is the definition that we teach to our students and what staff regularly review with them. This is ISBE's definition of bullying. As you can see, it is much more detailed than the ALBAIS definition. With the information here, I do want to point out, I won't read it to you, but ISBE allows for a single instance of bullying to have occurred without it being repeated. So if it is severe or significant enough, it could constitute bullying behavior. So that's one of the delineations from the ALBAIS definition that we teach the children. But this is the one we're bound to when we're reporting instances of bullying. So first I'm going to talk about victimization. And as I mentioned before, this is one of the areas that we made some changes to our practices to align with our policy. So we wanted to use language from our restorative justice training and initiative that we're doing within the district. So staff has been trained on this. You might have heard your own children participating in some sort of circle in order to really build community. So we're kind of in the beginning stages of using this type of approach. But one of the things that this approach uses is person who is harmed or perceives to be harmed, and person who's the harm doer. So whether or not actual harm is done, as indicated by an adult, we do want to acknowledge that students may feel that they were harmed in certain situations, and we have to honor that, and mainly because they may need additional support simply because of the perception of the situation. So it may not rise to the level of a bullying situation, but it is something that we want to monitor more closely for our student population. With that, we are really looking at widening our social emotional net. We want to catch as many kids as possible with looking at who is harmed more broadly and not so narrowly as just those who have experienced bullying. In doing this, we can identify students who need more support earlier because they're going to come up on our list, even though they may not be necessarily identified as somebody who has been bullied or even the one completing the bullying. And we're also looking at ways that we could increase supervision in different areas if we're seeing a certain area within the building come up a lot, but not necessarily within our straightforward bullying data. And it would allow us to also have additional class meetings if we see like one group of students is constantly having problems. So we could work on having an opportunity for those students to get together and really work through some of these issues and hopefully resolve it in a way that works for all students involved. Next, I'm going to look at some of the data that we've collected. Now, with the data that we've collected, I do want to say you have to view it very hesitantly because we rolled this initiative out, our new practice, in January, and we ended in March with the school closures. So this is definitely not a complete year. So we're missing a lot of data to that point. So this is our students reporting harm. This is based on a percentage of the population of the buildings. I did combine Lions Park and Fairview for this data. So you can see across the board, everyone is below 5% in this number of students who have been reporting harm. With this information, I will note for some of the younger grades, especially first and second, it's a little bit higher. And I do believe that that is related to students just learning how to get along with each other. So they're perceiving more harm is done because they're working through and navigating some of those social situations, which I do is very natural time period for students to do so. Now, I'm not going to say that that is the case for all of these instances, which is why it's something that we need to review on a regular basis to make sure we are supporting all of our students' needs. But it'll be really hard to draw any broad conclusions based on this year's data. Going into next year, I'm more hopeful that we'll have just better data to look at. But given the last presentation, that's probably unlikely. So it may take a few years for us to get good data to make better decisions on. But it's definitely something that the teams within the building can use immediately, and it's not necessarily looking at it in the aggregate form that'll be valuable, but just making sure we're meeting individual student needs. For the second area, looking at observations of safety at the school, I just want to note the areas that we do that or how we do that. We have regular communication to all staff on how to report instances of bullying that they may observe through staff meetings. We also updated our district website this year and started a communication schedule with families to encourage reporting. So it's not so much driven just by the school if they're noticing instances, but if parents are aware of their child coming home upset, we're highly encouraging families to reach out to us so we can engage with the students who are involved in those situations. All of the buildings have different procedures in place for students to report and let us know if there are any concerns within that we might not be seeing or they might not be reporting to another adult. And finally, we also use our OVAS bullying questionnaire, which is a survey for all third through eighth grade students that we collect additional data. And I will show you a couple components of one component of that survey that I thought was really meaningful. The survey is quite lengthy, but for this one, looking at the percentage of girls and boys who have been bullied 2 to 3 times a month or more. So this is a self-report for our students in third through eighth grade. So I did we are looking at the combined view of boys and girls. So you can see our data are the blue bars and the red line is the national comparison. So just to put it in perspective of how often our students are reporting compared to students nationally. So our students are reporting fewer instances compared to national data. But this is obviously something that we want to limit as much as possible. But as I was saying earlier, with some of the higher reports for that first and second grade data, you can see third graders report higher in this data. So again, it could be just related to learning through those social situations. I don't necessarily think that we have more instances of bullying in third grade than any other grade, but the perception might be there, and that's something that we have to address, even if it's not identified as a bullying situation. So the final three components for board review are any instances of bullying that were founded. And again, this data is reported through March. We did not have any reports of bullying after March, not to say that we couldn't have reports of bullying during remote learning, because we are still held to the same standard of investigating anything that might occur. Through those instances, it'd be more likely to be such as a cyberbullying, but we would be looking into that should it have occurred. So we had two instances over the start of the school year, one at Westbrook and one at Lincoln. The locations of those incidents, one was in a bathroom and one was at home. And I'll explain the home on the next slide. So with the home instance, it was an instance of cyberbullying that it was brought to administrators' attention and investigated. And then the other incident was related to physical bullying. The final area that we really want to look at is whether bystanders either intervened to help the student that was on the recipient of being bullied, or if they participated and actually started to act as a bully as well. So in both of these instances, neither of those occurred. So we didn't have anybody stand up for the student that was bullied, but we didn't have anybody that also participated in the bullying behavior. So one of the aspects of ALBAIS is to teach students to be those upstanders. So you might have heard that language with your own children, but we do continue to focus on that because it's more likely that another peer will be viewing an instance of bullying, or even if it's just harm doing, than an adult will, because students know when adults are watching typically, and they're not likely to say or do mean things within the view of the adults. So we really want to teach students to stand up for each other. And if they're not comfortable doing that, at the very least reporting so we can intervene as adults. And then finally, I just want to review what the social emotional learning looks like in District 57. We do have our ALBAIS bullying prevention program. We teach school-wide expectations, which is done throughout the school year and not just at one time for all of our students. And then we have restorative practices, which looks at building a good climate and culture, that community, so people feel welcome and their voices are heard, and we have a very equitable and open place where students can congregate. So I try to be brief, but please let me know if you have any questions.
You were very brief, that was great. Does anybody have any questions to start with?
I have a couple.
Vicki, go ahead.
Yes. Well, thank you so much, Sarah, for your presentation. I just want to, I had two questions. First, I know you said this at the beginning, but I just want to be 100% sure I understand. So besides this slide where it specifically asks if you've been bullied two or three times a month or more, all of this is measuring, it could be measuring a single incidence of bullying as defined by ISBE, not necessarily repeated instances.
So no, so this is actually using the definition of the ALBAIS.
Okay, so the obeys, and that is B. Yes. Okay.
And that's why, Vicki, that it frames that question that way, that we're looking at 2 to 3 times, because if it's an instance of one, obeis would not necessarily count that as a bullying situation.
Right. Okay. And then you mentioned, I mean, some of them do break it out between Fairview and Lyons Park, but the one, the victimization data where students reporting harm, you mentioned that Lyons and Fairview data was combined. And I was just curious if you, I mean, the numbers are small, but did you see any like big differences between the two, or is it pretty?
No, it was very similar. Comparable.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
You're welcome. Anybody else a question? I had one question. I didn't send it ahead, and I don't know if you will, if you might have the answer or not. I understand if you don't, you can get this to me. But in regards to the percentage, with, you know, each grade level, has there been an increase or a decrease per se over the last 3-5 years, something like that? Any type of where you see, oh wow, that's really creeping up, or, you know, that's going down? I'm just curious.
Sure. And Eileen, I am prepared for this question. Okay. I did have to talk to you the last 5 years.
Imagine my surprise.
So actually, there has not been a wide variance in our data over the last 5 years. So the slide I showed you is pretty consistent with previous years. So that is interesting that we're not seeing a big impact of what types of supports we have in place with how students are reporting. So I think it's for a number of reasons in how we're teaching students what bullying is, but I also do think it's how we're addressing those harm situations. So I feel my opinion is with restorative practices, we will see somewhat of an improvement over time because it is more about that community building, and with community building, students will be more likely to be those upstanders and intervene in different situations. So I have hope that the subsequent data is more positive.
Great, thank you. Anybody else have any questions? Okay, thank you very much, Sarah. Appreciate it. It was a great presentation.
Thank you.
Now we're gonna move on to financial projections and budget assumptions.
Hello. You have a memo in your packet, which kind of outlines some of the specific details. This is the overview that I will give and then give some time for questions. So this is the first stage in building the budget, looking at the assumptions and the financial projections. Without further ado, and as I mentioned during the readiness plan, we're in a crisis, and this is a crisis budget. So looks very different than we had these last few years after the passage of the referendum. But as we know, we need to allocate funds and resources for PPE, additional staff members, prepping for remote learning and such. So this is, you know, no qualms about it that this is a crisis, and you will definitely see that, you know, in these next few slides. Overall budget process looks pretty much the same, beginning with the board approving the staffing plan and then meeting with the administrators. Biggest change this time around is knowing that some cuts had to be made. There were some cuts made throughout the building budgets and some of the department budgets. So some of those, you know, surface level conversations and more in-depth conversations, you know, were had, but tried to be able to make those adjustments wherever possible. Tonight, we're standing here looking at the budget assumptions. I'll come before the board in August to discuss and present the tentative budget, and then we will come back in September to approve the official budget. On the revenue side, you know, a majority of our revenues come from local sources. This time around, property taxes make up 81%. Taxes are driven by both CPI and new construction. On the local side, we know because of the economy, the corporate property taxes will definitely decrease because of the Fed and the cuts in the economy. The interest income will decrease. We will still get money from registration fees. Too early to tell with an economic impact if the registration fees are going to decrease with more fee waivers or people being out of work and not being able to pay. The good news on the state side is the governor says that the budget will allow for school districts to get the same amount of money that they got before. This was a big concern for me and the district a few weeks ago, but when the budget was passed by the General Assembly, state sources were left alone, and that is definitely a positive thing on the revenue side. As far as federal sources, still have money coming in from Title I, Title II, Title III grants, special education grants, some Medicaid dollars, and as we mentioned this evening, hope to see that money coming in from the CARES Act to help supplement things. From a graphic standpoint, this shows you the breakdown, 81% property taxes, 9% of that other local revenue, and then 6% being that largest part coming from the state with the new evidence-based funding formula, and then 3% coming from the federal government. Quick little graphic taking a look at historical trends. We know several years ago with the referendum and that dip, we had a large increase with the fiscal years, and then there was a slight decrease just based on how Cook County distributes the levy. Now we're getting back into that upward trend of where we're seeing revenues increase slightly over time and over the next 5 years. Expenditure side looks a little different. We talked about in the presentation, we will be making some staffing increases to help with in-person learning, looking at 4-day custodians to increase with sanitizing and cleaning. That's one in each of the buildings. We're also looking to add 4 nurses assistants to help monitor 6 students and staff members, assist in the record keeping and the communication. And we talked about having kind of that separate isolation room that nurse's assistant will be monitoring students when they're in that isolation room and really working not only with the nurse in the building, but also under the umbrella of the district nurse in keeping everybody safe. Salaries and benefits make up the largest portion of our budget. Teachers looking at that 2.1% base with the step gives you a 5.1% increase overall. And ESPs as a result of the first year of a new contract shows a 6% increase for ESP members. Administration approximately is a 33% increase. And then like previous years, we budget additional dollars for both substitute teachers and lane changes. On the benefits side, all the coverages stay the same per the collective bargaining agreements. So on the single side, board pays 90%, and on the family side, splits it with the employee 50-50. When it comes to dental, those insurance levels are a little bit more generous, 98% for single coverage, and then 60 for family. And then on the dental side, not the health insurance side, there is an option of a single plus one where the board picks up 90% of that. Some other purchases and expenditures that go into the overall picture. Some of the technology purchases, just want to point out, we're replacing the Lions Park intercom system this summer. Staff computer replacement is always on the docket with different rotation levels that will be happening again this fiscal year. We'll also be doing some internal fiber upgrades which will help on the network. And as mentioned and alluded to in the previous presentation, some additional Chromebooks being purchased for those primary grades to allow us to be one-to-one in the case of us going full remote learning. NSSEO is always based on student needs. This particular year, we budgeted a little over $310,000. And as we know, that figure always fluctuates based on, you know, students coming in and out of the program. One big adjustment in trying to balance this budget is looking at capital projects and construction and scaling that down significantly. You know, in previous years, I've talked about $4 million in three consecutive summers. This would have been the third consecutive summer, but looking at this crisis budget and trying to balance, we won't be looking at $4 million. We'll be looking at $2.5 million. And then, as I mentioned also in the previous presentation, that PPE, as of today, put in a placeholder of $500,000 and definitely a possibility of that looking a little higher. Breaking down my object, salary portion is a little higher at 55%. Second one being benefits. And then purchase services, supplies and materials, and capital outlay, pretty much staying consistent with previous years. That other objects in this graph is referring to payments to NSSEO. That's at 4% of our budget. And then the non-capitalized equipment that is purchased but is less than our $5,000 threshold falls into this category. You know, I've stood here before the board in past years saying that, you know, I'm always going to work to balance the budget. I have to be honest here in saying that this is going to be a very hard year to do that. However, with the crisis being the crisis, everyone understands that, you know, the why of this. With that being said, as we get numbers, as we get closer to September, within reason, I'm going to try to make that deficit or surplus in this year as close to zero as possible. But please, I need the board to understand that this is going to be much more challenging than it has been the last few years. The good news is the relationship between the year-to-year budget and the fund balance projections do not directly correlate. Our fund balance projections are still looking in a very positive direction. Those are the red line. That blue line is the 30%. That's our fund balance policy, stating that we cannot go below 30%. So as far as a looking at this 1 year as a blip on our screen and looking to return to close to normal financially, looking out 5 years, we're still in a very good spot, which I'm very happy to stand up here and state. Unknown financial variables, COVID-19, you know, is a big one, not only with purchases to PPE and such, but what kind of economic impact that's going to have on us, both locally, statewide, and the federal government. If the state did not commit to fully funding education, this presentation would look very different, but that's something that always needs to be kept in mind. And seeing here if things change over the next 2 months. And the same items that have been part of my presentation for the number of years, TRS cost shift still out there, property tax freeze still out there, and then other possible legislation that may be introduced either in the fall veto session or as part of the overarching items that come up in the new session in January. So with that, I will take questions related to the financial projections.
Okay, does anybody have any questions?
I have a question.
Yes.
Go ahead, Kim.
I just want to be clear, Adam, certainly it's understandable given the current circumstances and the emotional impact that the pandemic has had on all of us. I just want to make sure I'm understanding the rationale behind the shortfall that you're projecting.
Mm-hmm.
It appears from what you've said, it has to do primarily with the economic impact on commercial property and also on our investments. I know you've always done really well at managing our portfolio and really growing that aspect of our revenue. Is that where you expect the shortfall is coming from?
On the revenue side, that's definitely where the shortfall is coming from. On the expenditure side, between PPE, hiring more staff members, there's considerably more expenditures where the revenues can no longer easily outweigh the expenditures.
Okay, so, and it sounds like you're working to mitigate that by cutting back on some of the construction that we talked about.
Correct. Correct, which again, understanding this is a crisis year, but we definitely don't want to fall into the same issues that we fell into several years ago with deferred maintenance and not moving forward with, you know, major capital projects. Going back to the promises of the referendum, but with the understanding of where we are this particular year and hoping that we're looking at a one-year crisis budget and then going back to, you know, we're not going to be able to go back to 4 million. I mean, what's lost is lost. We're not going to be able to recover that, but being able to get, you know, raise that a little bit so that we can still start to cross some of those things off the list that have been on our plan for a while.
Okay. And I think you answered the next part of my question, which was to what degree this crisis budget can actually be contained or will there be outfall in subsequent years? And it sounds like if we have to come back on some aspects of our budget this year, they won't be able to be recouped at the same level in 5 years.
Mm-hmm. Now, going back to my last slide about the financial unknowns, if this crisis goes longer, where we're going into, you know, 2022, and we're still, economy still not recovering, we still need to hire staff, more staff, we still need to, you know, purchase more PPE. Obviously, that projection for FY22 and years after that will look different. But right now, this is set up with the idea of next year, FY21 is the tough year, and then we'll be able to, you know, return to some type of normalcy. Definitely want to be upfront with the board with that also.
Okay, thank you very much.
Anybody else have any questions?
I actually have a couple of questions.
Sure.
Go ahead, Jerry.
You said 500,000 on PPE.
Yes.
Is that the total COVID spend for this year or is there something more? Cause the numbers aren't working out for me part of it is I don't see. So the revenues from last year, we're probably around 30 million, right? So we had a 2.7 or 2.8% increase over last year. So,
So the revenues are going to fall slightly, but the expenditures are going to increase more.
Oh, it looks like our revenues are going up 2.8% from 2021. Or am I reading that wrong? The 2.77%,
but in the FY20 model, the revenues do not outweigh the expenditures. Expenditures are higher, so we don't have enough money coming in to cover the money that's going out.
In the 20 model.
Okay. I'm on the slide right now. I'm looking at the 21 model. So in the 21 model, we do not have enough revenue to outweigh the expenditures.
And if I was looking at 20 by comparison,
the budget for 20 was balanced.
Right.
The issue with 20, and again, the audit isn't completed. These are all audited numbers. The issue with 20 is because of COVID and what started to happen in March, the revenue that was supposed to come in did not all come in or was reimbursed. So the food services, transportation, some Circle of Friend payments, all that revenue that was supposed to come in was then reimbursed to families. So on the FY20, when it gets to our FY20 final, it will not look as good as budgeted because all those revenues that were slated to come in did not come in. In addition to that, corporate property tax started to decrease, the overall investments with the Fed dropping the interest rate, that started to decrease too. So even though FY20 was a balanced budget to begin with, when the audit is completed, it will be very close.
Okay. And then my second one's just a comment. I feel like, we were focused on trying to keep it balanced. I guess, we should probably look at what the projects are, but, if we had to cut back to 2 million, I guess that would be my preference, is to cut back to the 2 and keep things balanced for the year, versus, knowing that, hey, we had to react to COVID and, we'll take the highest priority items.
The only issue with that is, as we know, construction is always spread between two fiscal years. So this 2.5 million in FY21, a majority of this is part of the summer construction that's going on right now. So to be able to cut that much more than, maybe a little bit, I have to, take a look at, the final kind of where we are with construction numbers prior to September. But because of those are tied to construction projects that have already been awarded, there's no way that 2.5 can be cut to 2 million.
Oh, okay. So we're going to have, so in this coming summer, a lot of the spend is really will be falling into that 3 million that's earmarked for fiscal 2020.
And on that note, I'm going to have to be, very strategic. So, we usually, we start construction in June. A majority of the money that's being spent is in, July and August, but have to really work with the projects to figure out, where we're not spending a ton of money in June out of this year's budget, because frankly, we're not going to have that money in this year's budget.
Okay. Thanks.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Does anybody else have a question?
I do. Just real quick. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Rachel, go ahead.
Okay. So just to clarify though, Adam, I think you said it earlier, but typically, as far as any construction, et cetera, the maintenance that we've been doing, you would have spent closer to 4 million for fiscal year 2021. If
yes.
The reduction is to 2.5, balance, yes, because of the projects, what's in is a majority of it because of the projects that started this year. So there has been a reduction in that. Is that?
Yeah.
Am I hearing you right? Okay. I just want to confirm that because I think that's important. I get if we're tied to projects that started this summer. Okay. Obviously, if there's any other way to sharpen some of that, I think that's important. But we also want to make sure we're always looking, and I know we do this, but any of the critical projects from safety, like anything that's always deemed as a priority from our outside consultants, and from the architect, like we just want to make sure that we're continuing to maintain that, at least at the bare minimum.
Yes, agree.
Okay, that's all I had. Thank you.
Sorry, that was Jen, not Rachel. Sorry about that, Jen. Anybody else have a question? Okay. I just want to make a comment regarding...
I'm sorry, I was muted.
Oh, okay, go ahead, Vicki.
Yes, I'm sorry. P- for interrupting you, Eileen. I forgot I was muted. I just had a question. So I saw that some of the bigger ticket items that we're anticipating for this fiscal year are the PPE and the nurses' assistants. Do you anticipate, let's say we are fully online in the fall and it stretches into the winter and who knows how long, are you thinking that, are there expenses related to that that might offset some of the savings that we would have if we didn't have to invest in, you know what I'm saying? Like, would you see then that it would be more likely that we would have a more balanced budget if we didn't have to, if we weren't in person at all this fall and possibly in the winter?
I think it's possible. The tricky part is figuring out how long we would be in remote learning if that comes through. So for example, and I don't have the number off the top of our head because we're constantly ordering stuff every single day. So let's say we've spent $200,000. So that money's already spent. That stuff's going to come in. The good thing is with most of this stuff, it's not going to go to waste. We're going to be able to use it, especially with all the cleaning supplies. So if for example, we, you know, remote learn for the entire year, then yes, we'll be able to save on some of that PPE because we wouldn't have to pay to replenish those items. Mm-hmm. With that being said, things, the added staff for the extra day custodians and the extra nurses' assistants would not be necessary because we wouldn't have students in school.
Right.
So, and then I think, I mean, that's where it's kind of out of our control. But if the governor is going to make a decision like that, you know, the earlier that he would do that so that we all can prepare for that, not only financially, but, you know, logistically and safety and teaching and learning would, you know, would just help us as a district.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Does anybody else have a question?
Can I just make one request, actually, Adam?
Sure.
When we look at it in August, could you put in the preliminary fiscal year 2020 as a column, just as a comparator, or maybe it's a different page so you can kind of see those two side by side? I think that would be helpful.
The FY20 budget to the projection?
Yeah, or the preliminary 2020 financials. I know they're not audited yet, but the unaudited financials, sure. Through, yeah,
sure.
That would be helpful to see that same kind of as a side.
As part of the tentative budget and the official budget, we always do the year over year. Where you'll see the 20 next to the 21, so that we will see that.
That's what I guess I'm struggling with a little bit on this one, because I'm seeing the percent increase, but the numbers just are, it's easier to see the numbers, I think, to look at it that way.
Okay. Yeah, no, for sure.
Okay. Okay. I'm going to just ask, it's more actually just a comment, but, in regards to the $2.5 million, how it's being split, because it's from 2020 and it's reaching into 2020 summer projects are reaching into the 2021 budget for that. I mean, just so we know, the fund balance is still at that 43%. Next year it's at 45. So we're still maintaining well above our 30%.
Correct.
And which is great. And then it is nice to know that we still, I mean, we want to do the projects that we need to do, especially, and we have that money there. And if revenues were to change somehow with what we get from the state or what we get from the federal government, or expenditures increase again because of certain issues, because of COVID, it is still good to know that we are that high and that we can still dip into that if we absolutely have to.
Definitely.
So it's a positive.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Adam. Does anybody else have any questions? Okay, we're going to move on to the next thing. We are up to you again, Adam. Update on the summer facilities project.
Yes. As always, in July, you know, at just about the midpoint of the summer, this is where we just kind of give a brief update of the projects that are out there and where we're going. Some of this may be a little bit technical, but it's always nice for you to, you know, the board as a whole to be aware of these certain things. So I'm just going to go building by building, project by project, and then just kind of, you know, give a short semi-technical explanation of where we are. So we're going to begin at Lincoln. Project was to replace the HVAC unit and install air conditioning in the Bussey gym. So all of the gas and electrical piping has been completed, and we're waiting for the chiller to be powered up. So good position there. Project to repair and repaint all the hallway lockers. All have been repaired, and the painting has just recently finished. Look forward to showing some pictures at a later date with that. Replacing all the floors in the classrooms, cafeteria, and locker rooms. So all the new floors in the classrooms, cafeteria have been completed, and the locker rooms are going to be completed next week. And as far as adding the two generators, emergency generators to assist, the electrical and gas have been completed, and we're just waiting for the generators to be powered up. So all good news over there. Moving over to Westbrook, we are replacing some HVAC controls. The electrical work is in progress right now. We're also replacing the asphalt and the basketball courts over there. You know that that has not been done in many years. There were cracks and bumps, and so the area has been demolished. The grading is completed, and the testing is occurring right now before the new asphalt can be laid. And then installing the sensory floor in the early childhood hallway. The carpet is currently being laser jet cut, and that is hoping to be, or we're looking to install that that first week of August. Moving over to Lyons Park, rebuilding and expanding the parking lot. Lyons Park, as we know, was done first. So the parking lot's been demoed. All the underground utility and storm retention has been completed, and the digging and the grading is in process right now. As far as the large chiller and the air conditioning in the gym, all the electrical and gas have been completed, and we're waiting for that chiller to be powered up. Moving over to Fairview, where we are also rebuilding and expanding the parking lot. Lyons Park is being done first, Fairview is being done second with the crews. So over at Fairview, that parking lot has been demoed. The underground utility and the storm detentions currently being worked on right now. And then finally, over at the administration building, building the receiving dock or receiving room at the dock entrance. The room has been built, the doors are installed, the area has been painted, and we're just waiting for the electrical to be hooked up. So that is the brief update. Overall, things look good. And again, whether it's a physical walkthrough in August or a virtual walkthrough, I am happy to show both the board and the community the progress that has taken place.
You could do one of your wonderful camera walkthroughs.
I'd be more than happy to do that.
That'd be great, if need be. Does anybody have any questions? All right, we're going to move on. We are doing superintendent's report.
I hate to be a disappointment, but I have no report for you tonight.
Oh, goodness. All right. We are going to move on then to the consent agenda. And who did the financials, the bills this month?
Oh, I did.
Okay. Yeah. And how did it go, Vicki?
The bills, everything looks excellent. I did want to make a comment. So I know we just talked about our investments and how Adam's doing a great job. So actually, I just wanted to kind of highlight, I'm sure you already saw this, but, you know, so Adam took over as treasurer when? 2017? Yes. So if you look actually at the increase, it is amazing, actually. So June of 2018, it was about 12,000. June 2019, we were at 22,000. This was the interest earned on investments. And then June 2020, 64,000. So that is like a miracle. So amazing. Thank you so much, Adam, for, yeah.
Thank you.
I don't know how you do it, but yeah. like, I mean, yes.
Yeah. Going so straight to good. PPE. No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Adam, for doing wonderful investing for us. You've done a great job. You really have.
Anytime. Thank you.
All right. So can I get a motion for the consent agenda? And I believe we were all here for everything before, the last meeting and all. I believe we were. I did not check. Were we here all before? I honestly did not look at that before. Okay, good. All right. Motion?
Yeah, I'll do it. motion to approve the consent agenda. 1, minutes of the regular business meeting, June 18th, 2020, open session. Number 2, personnel transactions. Approve the employment of 1 certified individual. Approve the change of status of 1 certified employee. Approve the employment of 1 ESP individual. Number 3, financial reports, June 2020. 4, accounts payable bills. 5, approved donations report. 6, approved tuition reimbursement. 7, approve review of the closed session minutes for the period of July 2018 through December 2018. And destruction of closed session audio tapes prior to December 2018. 8, revised 2020 to 2021 calendar. That's it.
Second.
Vice President Chung?
Yes.
Member Fay?
Yes.
Member Kobus?
Yes.
Member May?
Yes.
Member McCluskey?
Yes.
Member Rotroff?
Yes.
President Kowalczyk?
Yes. Okay, we do not have any unfinished business, and I don't have any more community comments to read. I did it all at the beginning. I didn't save any for the end. So, and then new business really is only in regards to that first read of that policy regarding student parents with the adding addition of the masks. Is everybody fine with that? Any question on that? All good. All right. And then no need for board discussion because we've discussed quite a bit, but there will be a need for closed session. So can I get a motion to adjourn from open session?
Move to adjourn from open session.
Second.
Was that Kim who moved?
Yes.
And who seconded it?
Rachel.
Rachel, thank you. Member Fay?
Yes.
Member Kobus?
Yes.
Member May?
Yes.
Member McCluskey?
Jerry?
Yes. Sorry, I was muted. I couldn't get it off.
Member Rotroff?
Yes.
Vice President Chung?
Yes.
President Kowalczyk?
Yes. All right. So now we'll exit this meeting and we'll go to the next.
Right. Okay. Exit this okay. meeting. Fighting for the next okay. one. Correct.
All right. But thank you, Mary. Thank you, everybody. Go to bed. Oh, yes, enjoy the rest you. Of your night. If you night. Brush your teeth and get your pajamas on. Bye.
Bye. Bye.